Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Give me a thumbs up, Dominic, when we're good. All right. This is a public hearing being held by the Tompkins County Legislature today, August 17, 2021, at 5:30 p.m., concerning a local law adopting a youth deer hunting program, pilot program. I have one person who has signed up to speak on the public hearing, and if anyone else would like to do that, please indicate. So, Dick Costello.
Thank you, folks. It's a privilege to be back in the chambers with you again. I've been here before. This brief remark or two I'm going to make. Is that better? Okay, again, thank you for the privilege of being here. In my other visits, the main event was hunting. Hunting was a word that we're very seldom going to use tonight. This has very little to do with hunting. This is a completely different subject. As you know, the governor signed two bills this year. One was to allow 12-year-olds to hunt deer in New York State. That stands by itself. They are legal to hunt deer in New York State. The second part is in this room, for the counties to adapt a law that would allow them to use a rifle. There are two counties in New York State that have not done this yet, Erie and Tompkins. All the other states have opted into this. About a year ago or so, I was in these chambers encouraging the use of rifles for deer hunting in New York State, and you all passed that bill. And I must tell you, there were no incidents whatsoever, no incidents, no accidents, no negatives whatsoever during the season last year. It was 100% safe, which we're very grateful for. So having said that, as I'm repeating myself to a certain extent, this bill to allow 12-year-olds to hunt with rifles, it goes with some pretty strict guidelines. For example, they must be within one arm's reach of a hunter that has 21 years of age, has 3 years or more of hunting experience. They both must wear blaze orange clothing. They both must hunt on the ground. These are safeguards that the New York State put in. And about a year ago, we had a discussion about rifle bills. My thinking is this way. If the state of New York set up the guidelines for these 12-year-olds to hunt, I think it behooves us to introduce an implement of safety as well. Ladies and gentlemen, that implement is a rifle, proven to be safer than any other weapon. A shotgun would be the other weapon to hunt deer. It's a proven fact. Statistics don't lie. I said that in these chambers many, many times a year ago. Given the fact that statistics don't lie, why wouldn't we adopt a yes vote to put a safe implement into that youngster's hands, along with everything else that's been in safeguard? That concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Costello. Is there anyone else to speak to the public hearing? Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing and open the Tuesday, August 17, 2021 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. Roll call of members.
Henry Granison.
Present.
Rich John.
Here.
Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Corman.
Present.
Mike Lane.
Here.
Dave McKenna.
Here.
Glenn Morey.
Here.
Martha Robertson.
Here.
Leslie Schill.
Here.
Mike Sigler.
Here.
Shauna Black.
Here.
Amanda Champion?
Here.
Deborah Dawson?
Here.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Present.
14 members present.
Thank you. Before we continue with our agenda, I just want to make a very quick Public service announcement for those who might be coming in, and for those of you in chambers, it's good to be back in chambers. And I'm happy that everyone is here. Just as a reminder that we have to wear a mask when we are here in chambers, please make sure that your mask is up and covering both nose and mouth. That is the recommendation. Is that what we expect here in chambers, just so we keep everybody safe? As we all know, the new variant of COVID-19 is wreaking havoc, and we're trying our best to stay open to the public, to have people be here with us, but we also want to be safe. So thank you all for complying. Henry, I wasn't picking on you. Because right in that moment you were taking a drink of water. But certainly do understand if people need to do that. So thank you all for being respectful of that request. Mike Lane.
On the screen, I wonder if we could have the gallery view so we could see who's here.
We have that set up for when they turn their cameras on, and people have their cameras off now. Let's see. They'll be pretty small when they speak, just as an FYI. It's different. So.
Are we going to see it on the screen? Up here?
If they keep it speaker view, we'll see a big picture of who's speaking. If not, we're going to see a small one like this, even when they speak.
Will we be seeing them on the overhead screen?
We've been using the overhead screen just for the presentations. We can certainly adjust. We found it to be a little distracting if the whole meeting is streamed up there when folks have their cameras off. But it's open to the guidance if you have otherwise.
I prefer it the way you have the speaker view.
All right, so we'll let Dominic play with it so we'll be able to, see who's speaking. And we'll move on. Thank you, Dominic. The rest of our agenda. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices. We have a few proclamations this evening, and I am going to invite some of my colleagues to read those proclamations on behalf of the entire legislature. Starting with Martha Robertson, celebrating Sue Dale Hall's contributions to the families in our community.
Thank you very much, Leslyn, and I'm delighted. There's Sue. Hi, Sue. And Nancy Potter, I think, is on the participant list as well. She was very helpful in providing me the information for the following. Whereas Sue Dale Hall has been our community's leading voice on behalf of children, families, and child care providers since she became executive director of the Daycare and Child Development Council of Tompkins County in August 1992, and earlier this year she announced she would retire at the end of August. And whereas Sue's goals for the council and the community were always to increase the supply of affordable, accessible, quality child care for all, improve business sustainability for providers so they are paid for the true cost of care, advocate so that no family pays more than 10% of their income on child care, and offer a menu of resources to support all families with what they need so that their babies thrive from the start. And whereas over the years, Sue has forged strong partnerships with employers and other community organizations such as the Tompkins County Chamber of Commerce, Cornell University, local school districts, Tompkins-Cortland Community College, the Human Services Coalition of Tompkins County, and the Department of Social Services to create greater opportunities for children and families. And whereas Sue has been a valued advisor, for example, helping to design Cornell University's child care employee benefit and advising on the development and construction of centers, including at Cornell and at TC3, and her study of the impact of child care on local economic development was replicated across the country. And whereas Sue supported on-site after-school child care programs at all elementary schools and expanded the teen pregnancy and parenting program, focused on improving child and family well-being and reducing foster care placement. And whereas Sue has played an active leadership role at the state, regional, and local level, advising policymaking, philanthropic, and community groups on initiatives for meeting children's and families' needs, and leveraging a variety of resources from public and private funders at all levels. And whereas Sue navigated the merger with the Cortland Area Child Care Council, launching the Child Development Council of Central New York, Incorporated, in 2011 and 12, organizing advocacy efforts with providers in Cortland and expanding family support services in Cortland County. And whereas Sue adeptly sustained and expanded council programs during the 2020-2021 pandemic, providing critical support and guidance to child care providers and families alike during the most stressful conditions, and managing CARES Fund and Tompkins County IDA disbursements for providers. And whereas Sue has inspired numerous interns, volunteers, donors, and employees to advocate for early care and learning policy, creating a legacy of advocates who will carry on her work for years to come with the mantra, kids can't vote, but you can. Ask your lawmakers to vote with kids in mind. Therefore, be it resolved that the Tompkins County Legislature recognizes Sue Dale Hall with deep respect and gratitude for her vision, leadership, and dedication to the youngest residents of our communities and all those who love and care for them. Resolve further that Leslie McBean Claiborne, Chairwoman of the Tompkins County Legislature, does hereby proclaim August 31st, 2021, as Sue Dale Hall Day in Tompkins County. So welcome and welcome here, Sue, and thank you so very much for your years and years of service. Yeah. Can't hear you. Sorry, Sue.
It's okay.
We can hear you now.
I just said thank you, everyone. Really appreciate it. It's just easy to do so much in a community like this one, that where everyone rallies together to make things right. We have a lot of work left to do for kids, but if anybody could do it, Tompkins County could do it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Sue. I'm going to miss working with you. Thanks for all you have done, indeed, and look forward to celebrating with you on August 31st, Sue Dale Hall Day. So I'll find you wherever you are. Thank you very much again, and thank you, Martha. Next, in the spirit of retirement, I'm going to move to Mike Sigler.
All right. Another person to recognize, Elizabeth Cree. So let me start. Whereas Elizabeth Cree has served Tompkins County for 34 years and as Republican Elections Commissioner for 24 years, and whereas she is widely respected across the state of New York for her breadth of knowledge on elections, election law, and the management of more than 300 mostly temporary workers, and whereas she's worked in concert with a number of Democratic elections commissioners, making Tompkins County a shining example of fair and transparent elections, a model for the state, and whereas her proudest moment was leading the election commissioners as the state president for the Election Commissioners Association during the 2004 presidential election. In 2004, the state changed from voting machines that had been in use for a century to paper ballots, and the state did so seamlessly. And whereas part of that transition required her to appoint a bipartisan team to reinvent procedures to make it easier, to make it an easier transition and bring together committees to ensure the integrity of elections were maintained and every vote cast could be counted. And whereas she oversaw the creation of early voting in New York State under the Early Voting Act, and whereas she was able to work with her Democratic counterpart in the midst of a pandemic to run a presidential and congressional election without issue, and assured every vote counted with many changes to voting, including a dramatic increase in absentee voting and increased early voting.
Whereas in 2005, she was awarded the Women of Distinction recognition by former Senator Mike Nozzolio in the New York State Senate. She has been a member of the Ithaca Rotary Club and served as the chair of Community Services. And whereas she has helped hundreds of candidates attain ballot access from all parties, and whereas she has kept up-to-date voter rolls, registered new voters, kept voting machines secure, recruited poll workers, and was key to running fair elections in Tompkins County since President Reagan was in office. Now, therefore, be resolved that the Tompkins County Legislature does hereby extend our deepest gratitude and recognition to Elizabeth Cree for her many years of leadership and dedicated service to the voters of Tompkins County and congratulate her on her retirement.
All right. Thank you.
And I do want to say that Elizabeth is watching at home with her sister, and she wanted me to tell everyone that she says thank you very much, and she was honored to work for the county for all these years.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Elizabeth. Glad you're watching, and certainly will miss chit-chatting with you whenever I come into the Board of Elections, but thank you for your service. All right. And next is Deborah Dawson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a proclamation in honor of Kyle Dake. Whereas Kyle Douglas Dake was born and raised in Tompkins County in the town of Lansing, and whereas Kyle began wrestling in peewee tournaments at the age of 5 and has worked hard and consistently ever since to improve his skills, and whereas Kyle won a spot on the schoolboy freestyle and Greco-Roman national team, and in 2008 on the Greco-Roman Junior World Team, and whereas Kyle's accomplishments include 2 New York State Championships in 2007 and 2009, and 4 NCAA Division I Championships while wrestling in 4 different weight classes for Cornell University, something only Kyle has ever managed to do, and academic All-American recognition for 4 consecutive years, 2010 through 2014, and a World Cup championship in 2018, and 2 world championships in the 74-kilogram weight class in 2018, and a Pan American championship in 2021. And whereas Kyle served as a volunteer assistant wrestling coach at Cornell University in 2014, and again in 2019 through 2020 while training for the 2020 Summer Olympics. And whereas Kyle qualified to participate as a member of the Olympic team representing the United States in the Tokyo Games. And whereas, despite a quarterfinals match loss and a medical condition that hampered his performance in Tokyo, Kyle bravely battled back to win a bronze medal for the United States. And whereas Kyle's talent, discipline, and commitment to his sport have set an inspiring example in Tompkins County youth and to student athletes everywhere, now, therefore, in recognition of Kyle's dedication and achievements, Leslie McBean Claiborne, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, does hereby declare Wednesday, August 18th, 2021, as Kyle Dake Day in Tompkins County.
Thank you, Deborah. And definitely thank you, Kyle. I don't know if he was able to make it this evening.
I don't know that he was, but he's been pretty busy since he got home.
I bet. Certainly we want to thank him for representing the U.S. and representing us well. I did watch the wrestling in the Olympics, absolutely loved it. And thankful that he brought home a medal and not only won to the United States, but to Tompkins County. So, yay. We really do appreciate it. All right, thank you. That's all we have for proclamations. Real quickly, I'm going to do a little shuffling. We are going to have an executive session this evening for the purposes of discussing personnel matters concerning a particular person and position. And if you will, and then I'll go to privilege of the floor for the public and municipal officials, legislators, I'll ask you to hold on because I would love to take up the resolution concerning the public hearing. So that those who are waiting can go home and have dinner. So let's move on to privilege of the floor for the public. Some folks who indicated that they wanted to speak. And my list starts with Heather McDaniel. Just a reminder to the public, you've gotten the rules sent to you, and we are asking you to keep your comments within the 3-minute time frame. Thank you. Heather.
Virtual platform that I can speak to you all. It's so nice to see you. I'm here tonight to address you regarding the American Rescue Plan funding. Among the stated objectives from the federal government to support immediate economic stabilization for households and businesses to address the negative impacts caused by the coronavirus pandemic. The recovery funds enable local governments to provide a wide range of assistance to individuals and households, small businesses, and impacted industries, in addition to enabling governments to rebuild public sector capacity. You already know this. I'm just repeating this from the federal government register for anyone else who's listening tonight. I was here virtually in June where I said this funding is a gift to every community in America. You were just handed $19 million, well, half this year and half next year, of course. You will make the decisions in how to best invest those funds in our collective future. In June, I asked you to support economic development. And I asked you to develop a process to consider funding and do it quickly. Our economy is in need today, now more than ever. I did watch the expanded budget committee discussion last week. I was one of three live, and I'm grateful to hear that you have tasked a committee, a small group, with making recommendations to the full legislature about how much of the $19 million should be used to support the community, as well as developing a process and evaluation criteria for funding requests. I have a few thoughts on this that I'd like to share with you tonight. First, I think you should aim high. $12.5 million, two-thirds of your award, should be used to address the negative economic impacts caused by the pandemic, from housing to childcare, social supports, infrastructure, workforce development and training, community and economic development, to name a few of the interest here. But think big. Invest in our economy for a more robust community tomorrow. Second, as you develop your goals and your process, consider including goals around, first, the backbone that has made our recovery possible, the healthcare industry, testing, vaccinations, treatment of COVID patients, and supporting frontline workers. Also, think about our future. Include goals around economic and community development, infrastructure that will make it possible for further private investment, workforce development and training for in-demand jobs, to get out-of-work community members trained into jobs that are ready to be filled today. There should be goals around entrepreneurship and small business assistance. These are our job-creating engines. And when you think about your evaluation criteria, consider criteria that are measurable, such as job creation and retention, private capital investment leveraged, estimated increased sales tax, room occupancy tax, and property tax. These are the building blocks of our municipal income.
Just wanted to let you know, Heather, that the time is up. So if you can wrap up, that'll be great.
In closing, I'm so thrilled to be a part of this community and the stakeholders that we've brought together to work on recovery. We've got a plan and we're working on actions, and we really are interested in working with the legislature to receive funding and also to use that funding to leverage other state and federal resources. Thank you so much for the time tonight.
Thank you, Heather. And feel free to also submit your remarks to us, your written remarks to us, so that we can also take a look at them. Thank you. Next in my list is Sue Compton. Sue, are you there?
Yeah.
There you are.
There I am. Hello. Thank you. I want to speak briefly in strong support of the proposed new site at 300 and 308 North Tioga Street for the new Tompkins County building. And as a county resident, I just want to recognize that proximity to the courthouse, proximity to downtown, and to multiple bus stops, I think, would serve the county residents really well. And secondly, I want to express a wish that the legislature and the those involved in planning and design also view this as an opportunity, a unique one, really, to protect the Boardman House as a community asset, to protect both its structural integrity, you know, as new buildings are put up and old ones are demolished, and to protect its presence downtown, both as an aesthetic and historic asset. I think the space immediately next to the Boardman House that is occupied now by a county building, a building that's slated for demolition, I would hope could be viewed creatively as perhaps a place to give a little space next to the Boardman House, perhaps for green space or for parking. And so thank you. I'm excited about this possible new plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. All right, next is Jennifer Tavares.
Thank you, Chairwoman McBean Claiborne, and good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for your time. I'm here also to talk about the Recovery Act funding and advocate for, you know, both a clear process and actual, you know, immediacy and some decision making around making these funding investments in the community to support economic recovery and workforce development needs. I'll apologize. Unlike Heather, I wasn't able to be at the last committee meeting, so I didn't benefit from all of that discussion. I am just excited to return from my time away to see that you have really thought deeply about some key areas for investment, about refining the process, and about beginning to create some criteria for this really complex decision making that you need to do in the next few weeks. I just wanted to reiterate and encourage you to prioritize economic recovery in a number of different ways. We know there's a lot of sectors that have been impacted, but some much more disproportionately than others. I see a continued recognition that the hospitality and tourism sector needs investment, but I do think that our strategic goals are more broad than that. And I think if we're going to call out specific industry sectors or make allowances, that list maybe needs to grow a little bit. So I know our team would be excited to work with you on that. Workforce development, recruitment, and retention remains a key concern for our community. Benchmarks such as job creation, retention, and also restoration, I think are really important to keep as indicators and to use as benchmarks as we're making funding decisions, as are projects and initiatives that have the potential to generate future income for our communities, you know, at the very small local level all the way up to, you know, the county as well. And just wanted to echo, you know, Heather's comment. I was thinking also about infrastructure. I don't see that clearly called out here, but we've talked a few times about investing in infrastructure needs and creating some additional funding mechanisms to support our development goals as a community and to really leverage this opportunity to be able to support the infrastructure that's needed and sometimes really difficult to pay for to achieve our economic and community development goals. And just, again, want to reiterate that it was a number of different organizations and partners that worked on the economic recovery strategy. We really encourage the city and the county to work together on how we can make some of these investments. I'm really excited everyone's moving forward on getting closer on these plans and how to create the process. But, you know, the timeline is really important. We need to be as short as possible for this money to have the biggest impact that it can. So just appreciate the continued partnership. Want to thank you for all the time that you put into this so far. And I know that all of us would be very happy to have additional meetings with county administration, any particular staff in your departments, or come back to any appropriate committees to talk more deeply about some of the priorities that we really think are critical to keep on the list at this time. So thanks again for your time. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Jennifer. Have a good evening. Anyone else? Leadership from Cornell University. COVID, but I wanted to see quickly before Cornell goes their municipal officials' reports and then take up that resolution. No reports from municipal officials.
Okay. All right. So if you will indulge me just a quick moment. Rich, this is your resolution, I believe, the one on the public hearing on deer hunting. We have people who are waiting, and if you all don't mind, please indulge me that we'll move that along.
Thank you, Leslie. I'd be very happy to move resolution number L, adoption of local law number blank of 2021, a local law adopting a youth deer hunting pilot program.
Seconded by Leslie Schill. We did have a public hearing this afternoon. Is there any discussion? Any?
Thank you, Leslie. This was discussed at the Public Safety Committee meeting, and it came to the legislature on a split vote. I think there's some concern that the resolution involves guns, and I am a strong believer that our country should be engaged in a positive discussion about gun safety that we can't seem to have. With that said, I don't really see this as a gun safety issue so much as a parenting issue, and I know you can see it your way, and we'll probably have a split vote here as well. But this seems to be one of the safer aspects of hunting. One of the questions I asked was there a history of accidents with 12-year-olds hunting? And the answer essentially is no, because there is a parent with them, and they're really watching them very carefully. The incidence of accidents is actually quite a bit higher with older males. So I'll leave that for whatever reason. I do note that the Democratic-controlled Assembly and Democratically-controlled Senate and a Democratic governor all passed this law on the state level. All of the upstate counties other than Erie and Tompkins have adopted it, and I believe Erie is in process of doing so. We need to act by September 1st to take advantage of the pilot program. And some interesting information about hunting across the country, that we are the only state that has a 14-year-old hunting age. States either have no minimum or it's 12 years old or even below. And I believe Pennsylvania, just to our south, has a 7-year-old hunting age. I'm not sure what to think about that, but it does seem like in these circumstances, with supervision, with the hunter safety course as a requirement, no tree stands, and the mentorship, that this is a reasonable step to support the community, the residents in our community that hunt. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. I have Annie, Mike Sigler, and Mike Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I looked up the ages for the accidents, hunting accidents in New York State through the DEC site, and I was only able to find last year, 2020 incidents, and the ages in that year were spread across all ages, including there was 22 hunting accidents, including an 11-year-old, a 13, a 15, and a 16-year-old. The 13-year-old shot his father in the head. I've heard at least some, when I'm talking to people, some people say, or I think it's been said here that, or possibly in the public safety meeting, that, well, they're going to have an education course. And they might have that course they need to have that course if they have a license. They also, for $19.95, they can take the course and not get their license, but just to be safer around guns. And I was glad to see that it was fairly affordable. I looked at other things that we have done or the state has done as far as related to age, and a couple of things that I came up with were that you have to be 16 years old to get a junior driver's license. You have to be 18, that's a federal law, I guess, to enroll in the military. And New York State some years back raised the drinking age from 18 to 21. And recently we passed a local law raising the age of the ability to buy tobacco products from 18 to 21. So to me, age does seem important. And so I'm just questioning why we would allow 12 and 13 year olds, and it's the law is to hunt with crossbow, rifle, shotgun, or muzzle-loaded firearms, which are larger than they're, to me, larger and more deadly. They seem like they have a little trouble. I got a better mask on, so it's a little harder to breathe. These type of hunting devices seem like they would have the ammunition go further. So that scares me a little bit. I'm perfectly myself okay with them waiting until they're 14, which is the current law, to be able to use these type of devices. And I guess that's about sums it up. So I will be voting against this. Thank you.
Thank you, Annie. Mike Sickler.
I want to reiterate something that was said. This actually is not a hunting law. It's an implement law, really. It's an idea that, 12-year-olds can already hunt with a parent or with a guardian. This is just the idea that we're going to allow them to use a rifle, just as we did last year, and allow people to use a rifle. It was brought up about ages and things like that, and someone had said that, about cigarettes and about the alcohol and, are they as dangerous as hunting? And I'm like, well, yeah, those are actually really dangerous, especially alcohol. But same thing with driver's license. Much more dangerous than hunting, frankly. So just some things that you are allowed to do. It's interesting to me, if we're bringing up ages, 14 years old, you can operate farm equipment. 10 years old, you can operate a boat. And we live on a 42-mile-long lake. That's a lot of territory. And, in fact, from this lake, you can get out to the ocean. So, yeah, you have a lot of freedom as a 10-year-old. I'm not trying to give you any ideas on what not to let people do, but that's pretty great. Now, that is with a safety certificate. And I bring that up because with no safety certificate, you have to go with an adult. So with a boat, you don't even, with a safety certificate, you can do that. And it seems like New York State has really made that a central piece of all these things. Like, even to drive an ATV, you need to have adult supervision unless you're on land that's leased or owned by a parent or a guardian. Or you take the safety course. So, again, it all comes back to a safety course or parental supervision. And in this, you're going to have to do both. So, listen, I know a lot of people that hunt. I know a lot of people that hunt with their children. Grandparents aren't going to be around forever, so I want them to be able to go out with their children and their grandchildren to hunt. And 12 years old, I know 12-year-olds that can do this. And they can do this because they're going to be with a parent. So I think that's just a way to kind of – there's a lot of knowledge that goes into deer hunting and other turkey hunting. And I would like to see that passed down from people who have actually done it for a while and know how to do it. And I think this is just really the next step. I think it's a good move for us. So, thanks.
Thank you, Mike. So, Mike Lane, and then I'll take this to a vote because I don't think any minds are going to change. Mike Lane?
Yes, I'm going to support this law. I think hunting is an important thing in our community. It certainly is in my district. We need to keep down the deer herds. We've had an overabundance in Tompkins County the last few years, as I understand it. We need to not let there be too many deer, because then there's just more auto deer accidents, which usually don't result in people being hurt, but sometimes they do. I was thinking about this over the weekend, and I like the idea that a 12-year-old who is learning needs to be within arm's length of an adult. Could be a father, could be an older brother, a grandfather, an uncle. And that will remind that 12-year-old about the rules of the hunter safety. But it will also remind the adult about those rules as well, and that they have a responsibility to make sure that they are doing the right things so that they are teaching the 12-year-old the proper way to handle a gun, to be walking through the woods, to be sure of a target, for example. Those are good things. And I see it as a two-way street, working both for the young people, but working for the adult supervisors as well. I like the idea that this is a trial program. It's similar to what we did a couple of years ago with the rifle thing. We said we would review it after 2 years to see what was happening. And I think that's a responsible way to go. So that's my feeling here.
Thank you, Mike. Martha, go ahead.
Yeah, a question. Rich, you said it was a split vote out of committee, but that's not shown here. What was the vote?
It was 3-2.
Can I say, find it should be on the record who was who?
Let's see, I think Glenn, myself, and Mike Sigler voted for, and Henry and Shauna voted against. Is that correct?
Except for me, because I'm not on your committee.
Oh, Dave, you were on my committee. Yeah, I apologize. Dave,
it was me.
Voted for it. Sorry.
All right. Thank you. I'm glad... Annie sent the message around today with a link to the to these incidents. I'm seeing a couple of them. Like, one of them was the 11-year-old had 3 years. 11-year-old had 3 years of out-of-state shooting experience, hunting experience. Did not have a New York license. Several others didn't have New York licenses. So I don't know how somebody's going to enforce this. Is there any reason why 12 and 13-year-olds can't go along with their parents and kind of just not shoot?
They can already hunt and get licenses and use other firearms.
Just not a rifle.
Just not muzzle loaders, shotguns, rifles, okay. Crossbows.
All right. I think we're good. I think I don't need to have it expanded. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's take this to a vote. So all in favor of the
May we have a roll call, please?
Resolution, roll call vote. Thank you. You can do that.
Henry Granison?
No.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
No.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
No.
Leslie Show?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
No.
Amanda Champion?
No.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
9 ayes, 5 noes.
Okay, that passes. Thank you very much. Thank you, Rich. Thank you to the folks through the public hearing. Are we going to go back to our agenda? And at this point, thank you very much to our friends from Cornell for their patience. You know, I started out this meeting just talking a little bit about, you know, our wearing masks and what's going on in our community, especially around the virus. There are already lots of questions in the community, as you can imagine, about the reopening of our colleges and universities. We know that at the end of last semester, you know, Cornell had announced that it will be reopened and for classes for students to attend in person. And so with this new variant, with everything that's going on, we wanted to have you join us today, and let's talk a little bit about, you know, what are some of the plans, what that looks like, should we be really, 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 really nervous, and anything else you can tell us about your plans regarding the virus and reopening. So thank you for joining us. We have, just for the record, and so folks know, we have Joel Molina, VP of University Relations. I did see Charlie. Yep, there he is, Charlie Krasansky, Associate Vice President for State Relations. Is Pat with us? Yes, Pat is there. APP Student and Campus Life. Karen, I see Karen, Director of Communications, Students and Campus Life, and dear friend Gary Stewart of APP for Community Relations. Thank you all for joining us, and take it away.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and to all members of the legislature for inviting us to provide this update to you. Even though for many, summer still has a number of weeks. For all of us in academia, summer has ended. But along with that is the excitement that, frankly, I was able to feel as I was out and about campus today after the rain had stopped. Seeing so many students and still some families who are beginning the process of dropping them off for the start of the academic year. Before I provide the update, I want to start by acknowledging and thanking the county. I've talked a lot in these forums over the last year about key partnerships. Our partnership with the county is at the very top in terms of our ability to stay connected with each other, for us to share with each other and to learn from each other. And I specifically want to call out the Tompkins County Health Department. I know that the health department will follow us on the agenda tonight, and Frank Krupa, and especially Amy Hendricks and Dominic Recchio, who may not always get the notice that Frank tends to get. But one thing in particular that's proven enormously helpful: Amy and Dominic every Monday morning hold what are critical weekly meetings with all three of our higher education campuses in our community, with the county, with Cayuga Health System. And these calls have been absolutely essential, and we know and certainly appreciate that they wouldn't happen without the county's leadership. So I want to talk just a little bit about our approach to this semester, and then we'll have time for questions from all of you. We had a virtual town hall where we had about 2,500 of our faculty and staff participate. This was last week, and President Pollack at that event noted something which we all, I think about, but she expressed it well, which is the one predictable aspect of COVID is its unpredictability. And we had hoped earlier in the summer that we would have a fall semester that was as free as possible from protocols and restrictions. But COVID has evolved, and the Delta variant has certainly evolved, that even though we are retaining our core focus on science, it is that attention to science that our modeling team has helped us to analyze and that resulted in our adjusting some of our protocols for the semester. And those protocols fall under three core areas. Number one, vaccination. Number two, testing. And number three, masking. And I'll start with masking because once again, it was the county leadership on July 30th when the health department announced that it would be reinstating an indoor mask mandate. We were quick to jump in and support and to institute an indoor mask mandate as well for our campus. So all of our students, faculty, and staff, as well as visitors, regardless of their vaccination status, are required to mask while indoor settings. Outdoors, for our unvaccinated individuals, they must also wear a mask outdoors when they're not able to maintain 6 feet of physical distance. But let me talk a little bit about vaccination. All of our students, undergraduate, graduate, and professional, are required to be vaccinated. And yesterday morning was the deadline for submitting proof of vaccination or deadline for requesting medical or religious exemption. Any student who isn't able to be vaccinated before they move in will be vaccinated or begin the process of vaccination immediately upon their arrival. And Cornell Health is hosting a number of on-campus vaccination clinics over the coming days. Faculty and staff, while not mandated, are strongly encouraged to be vaccinated. And we are really proud of the exceptionally high rates of faculty and staff vaccination. One proof point, 99% of our faculty are fully vaccinated. And we take every opportunity to urge any unvaccinated employees to take what is, as we all know, a critically important step to protect not just themselves, but the campus community and the broader Tompkins County community. And all members of our community have to submit, they have to upload proof of their vaccination status via our online portal. Finally, let me give you an overview about testing. And this is an area we were not anticipating having a continuation of our surveillance testing program. But as we've talked about now for all these months, it's the identification and isolation of asymptomatic infections that are an essential part of the strategy to curb the spread of COVID. And our modeling supported the need to test many vaccinated individuals so that we can identify breakthrough infections. And we are going to be analyzing, as we have, all data among those who are vaccinated. We'll do working with the health department careful contact tracing, and we'll be sure to direct additional contacts to testing. And this will enable us to have the most readily available data so that we know whether we need to make our protocols perhaps more stringent or perhaps relax our testing needs as soon as we are able. So let me walk through some of the testing elements. Student arrival testing. All unvaccinated or partially vaccinated students must participate in arrival testing prior to their being granted access to residence halls or other campus facilities. Any unvaccinated or partially vaccinated students will be required to participate in surveillance testing twice a week, two times a week until they're fully vaccinated, or continually if a student has an approved medical or religious exemption. Now, in addition, we are going to be requiring weekly surveillance testing of some vaccinated student populations. All undergraduates, all of our professional students at the law school, at the veterinary college, at the Johnson School, and in architecture, art, and planning will at least initially be required to participate in weekly surveillance testing. Now, graduate students, while not mandated for surveillance testing, may opt in to weekly testing. On the employee side, all faculty and staff either have to be fully vaccinated and submit proof of vaccination, or they will need to participate again in twice weekly surveillance testing while also complying with mask wearing requirements for the unvaccinated. And similar to students, we are also going to be for fully vaccinated faculty and staff, requiring surveillance testing for certain cohorts of faculty and staff who are going to be notified that because of the nature of their work interactions, they will be required once a week to be surveillance tested. And again, anyone is able to opt in to a regular program of testing, or just on a as-needed basis. Let's say someone does some travel and returns back to campus, and they want that extra certainty. They can opt in to a supplemental test at any point. Let me stop there. I know that there's a lot that I covered. I am joined, as you mentioned, by some colleagues that can speak to greater details around our students, around our processes, around our interactions with the state. So please, back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Joel, for that. And I'll open the floor for questions on anything Joel has shared, and others might be able to answer as well. Any questions, thoughts, feedback? Eileen?
Joel has been such a help with our airport and air services over many years, and particularly during this time when air service was reduced to almost zero because of COVID. Thank you all for being at the Air Services Board yesterday and presenting to that group. And I know they were very pleased to hear from you and many of the things, Joel, that you've just said now. So I want to just continue to say we sincerely appreciate all that, President Pollack and all of you folks have made a commitment to help us with our Ithaca Tompkins International Airport. And we heard yesterday about the increasing flights over the rest of the year that we're going to be having. And thank you for that. And one very small question I have. Couldn't help being intrigued by reading an article, I think it was out of Tennessee, about counterfeit immunization cards, CDC immunization cards, coming in from China. I wondered, is that anything that we have to be concerned about? It's certainly at Cornell or even in Tompkins County. And how do we spot them?
That's an excellent question. I don't pretend to have the answer of how we will successfully spot them. I do know that when I referenced the uploading of proof of vaccination, it is the CDC card that is the basis of that. We do know that many of our foreign international students will be uploading other forms of that proof. So perhaps that's a conversation for our experts with Frank and his team, and perhaps with other governmental agencies as we try to work to ensure that such counterfeit actions don't proliferate.
Mike, that's a good question, but I also wanted to point out that, licenses, remember when driver's license, you can, go to Vegas and get one. So not just China, you can get it from just about, anywhere people learn how to do those things. Indeed. Martha, question, comment?
I appreciate the surveillance. Hi, everybody. I appreciate the surveillance testing. I know that's an additional expense, obviously, for Cornell, but I think it's going to tell us, the broader community, a lot about breakthrough infections as the fall proceeds, because there's obviously so many people might be carrying without any symptoms or only very mild symptoms. So that will be, I think, really important information. So thank you. A question probably for Charlie. We know not much is happening in Albany lately, but I was just wondering if you have any, prognostications about the new administration, about what that might do, might mean for the SUNY campuses, as well as just for Cornell's relations in general with the administration, state government.
So you're right, not a lot of detail yet. The lieutenant governor has some excellent people working for her who I believe are quickly, she is putting together a sort of the senior level of her administration. That's something she has to do because I think she's made it clear already that the senior people around Governor Cuomo won't continue under her. And then longer term, she has a choice of then staffing, you know, from the agencies, et cetera. Governors have a lot of ability to shape an administration to their liking. A couple things I just think are really significant. I can't lose sight of it. She made it clear she's running, you know, which is a, I would say sort of a good sign. It means that she's taking this job really seriously, that she's planning to do an excellent job quickly rather than just being a caretaker. And so just in general, you know, I'll let Joel continue, but I'll just say, you know, she knows Cornell well, the lieutenant governor. She's been to Cornell several times. She's talked to us about things. We've been in Albany meeting with her. She's very substantive. She's smart. She is very experienced on things like the upstate economy. Is one of the areas that she worked, overtime, doing for this governor. And so I'll just, you know, speak for myself. I think that, you know, I have a lot of confidence in her ability to not only lead, but also listen and do a good job of when it comes to the things you just mentioned, you know, higher education, SUNY, you know, upstate, things that we have in common. You know, I think she clearly understands, cares about, and I'll just end with this and really go back to Joel. But the people we know who work for her and are close to her are excellent people. And so that's a very good sign. But Joel, maybe you want to add more.
No, I would just say, I have similarly been very impressed, with the time I've been able to spend with her over the years on those trips to campus. Certainly from my observations, she's interested in all levels of policies and wants to hear from stakeholders at every level. So I'm very excited about the energy and the experience that she'll bring to this really important job.
Thanks very much. All right.
Mike Sigler and then Henry Granison.
Hey, Joel. My question is more like, listen, so you're a global institution.
I was talking to friends of mine, and they were saying that, you know, countries in Europe are actually shifting to just a different model, basically, a model of we're going to have to live with this this virus, which I guess is in a kind of a break, a different approach. I didn't know if Cornell, as a global institution, was thinking about adopting that model, and if it did, would that impact its U.S. operations, particularly its operations here in Tompkins?
Well, thank you, Mike, for the question. You know, it is certainly our hope that as a global society, we are able to bring this virus under control. But certainly, you can't discount that COVID will be with us in some form or another for a very long time. We are certainly approaching the challenge not from the perspective of how it might change Cornell. I don't think it will change Cornell, but rather how it will change our behaviors, how it will change the attention that we all must give to things like masking and vaccination and testing. So there have been not a single conversation I've been in that contemplates changing Cornell's approach to higher education and to the in-campus educational experience for our students.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Henry?
Yes, Joel, thank you for coming today. I know you talked about the science, and I assume that the Delta variant changed things for Cornell. And I was wondering whether Dr. Frazier has modeled things differently and whether those models would be available.
Yes, the modeling is ongoing and yes, will be available. I'll just have to check with Professor Frazier as to when the next
document will be able to be posted. All of the decisions and protocols I walked through are a result of the modeling. So certainly the Delta variant on the one hand has helped us to appreciate the importance to keep some of these protocols and procedures in place. But I will note one of the things that we are benefiting from, and there's been a lot of talk about, well, gee, how are we now compared to how we were a year ago? We are in a much stronger position having had the last 12 months on, well, yes, 12 plus months under our belt. We know how small the incidence of in-classroom transmission of the virus, for instance, was. And so we are able to note that the risk, and this is in the modeling, the risk of an individual contracting COVID in a Cornell classroom is 8 times less likely than being struck by lightning. And that is something that raises eyebrows in a really good way. This is not to say we don't need to be vigilant, but it is a recognition that this is not the it's not an entirely new situation. The Delta variant certainly is more aggressive, but we have 2 semesters of experience, and our students and faculty and staff have 2 semesters of experience that I think will come in extremely handy. And as you've noted, we will learn a lot over these next few weeks of the incidence of the virus, and to the extent we need to tweak our approaches, we'll be quick to do so.
Thank you.
Thank you. Shauna and then Leslie, and then we'll, you know, wrap this and see if others have things to say.
Hi there. I was wondering, we currently have 14 people that are hospitalized right now at our local hospital, and some of those are currently on ventilators. Can you tell me what Cornell's plan is if their students need to be hospitalized?
Sure. I would, of course, defer to the health department, but my sense is those hospitalizations are primarily, if not exclusively, among unvaccinated individuals. That is not to say that we aren't going to be focused and concerned as we track the incidence of the virus in our overwhelmingly vaccinated population. But certainly, I mentioned the weekly conversations that the health department convenes. There are many additional conversations that include both the health department and Dr. Stallone and colleagues at Cayuga Health System. And I'm confident that the contingencies are being discussed and planned for. Again, the hope, the expectation is that Cornell's population will not be increasing the demand on those hospital rooms and ventilators. Let me turn to Pat and Karen, maybe from your perspective. I know Cornell Health and the students are very much top of mind in for you as well.
So, I mean, I'll just say that we have a plan in place for quarantine and isolation, and that's been completed, and we do have some students in quarantine and isolation. It's not a very large number, but we do have some. We will continue to monitor, and we have put pretty strict protocols in place for students within the dining halls and also within the residence halls. So they must be masked unless they're in their own room with themselves or with their roommate. In the dining halls, we will be providing takeout containers for any student that wishes to do that. We'll provide them free of charge, takeout container and takeout utensils. We're going to be putting tents up around the dining halls. So while the weather's good, students can eat outside, which is safer than eating indoors. For students that aren't vaccinated, we are going to set aside space in all of the dining halls where they can be socially distanced and masked and keep their masks on except when they're eating or drinking. So we're really approaching this from many different angles and trying to ensure that everything that we're doing is not just meeting the CDC codes and, New York State and Tompkins County, but, adding our own special sauce on it to make sure we're really, really, really safe. We have about 500 students that have moved in since the 14th, and the 19th starts our big move-in. So we'll have about 1,900 students on the 19th, another 1,500 on the 20th, and another 1,400 on the 21st, and then those numbers will drop down considerably. So we're going to have a busy week ahead. We're excited about it. As Joel mentioned, the students who are here already are in great spirits. They're lighthearted. They're having a good time. They're so glad to be here. They're so glad to be at Cornell. So, you know, we'll get through this together. And we've been working together now for, 17 months, and we'll continue to do that.
Thank you, Shauna. Thank you, Pat. Leslie.
Thank you all. Good to see you. Pat, you just answered a lot of my questions. What's going on with the students? Everybody in the community is always interested in knowing, when are the students coming back? What are the plans for students' arrival? Can you talk a little bit about the new dorm rooms that students are moving into? Because that's an exciting prospect as well.
Yes. So we'll have students moving into Toni Morrison Hall and Ganengdago. And I always trip up on that word. I'll get it right someday. We'll have that actually starting tomorrow, probably. And good news, we were under the gun. The furniture was delayed, but the gods of furniture smiled on us, and it arrived today. So they'll have beds, and they'll have dressers, and they'll have places to sit. The buildings are spectacular. They're beautiful. We did I will personally say we did an amazing job on a really, really tight budget. And I have to tell you that the new dining hall that's going to open in Toni Morrison in January is like nothing you have ever seen in a college environment. It is beautiful. It is beyond description. So I hope that all of you, when it's open, have a chance to come up and have a great lunch or dinner or breakfast. It's just, it's stunning, actually. It's actually stunning. So we're so excited about this. You know, it seems to me like this has been going on for, you know, forever. But then again, it's like, oh, we started this yesterday. So it's really exciting. And I think the students are just going to be thrilled.
And I will just add one additional note, stunning visually as well as from a sustainability perspective. We're very, very proud of what this building has been able to achieve in terms of its various functions and installations.
Yep. All right, Rich, thank you.
Thank you for coming and speaking with us. This is really helpful to have the direct communication. I just want, having been up on campus and getting ready to teach class up there, I wanted to give a shout out to the facilities and custodial staff at Cornell. The past year has been a remarkable achievement, and I think they played a really important part in keeping everybody safe. They really stepped up their game, and I just wanted to give them mention. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Rich. I'll be sure to pass on your comments to Rick Burgess and his team.
I just have a couple of quick things before we wrap and let you all go. You know, although you know, the governor opened up, you know, pretty much everything in New York. I wonder about, you know, gatherings and just discouraging and the messaging around that. What are you doing? I know the last time around, and I'm going to mess this name up real badly, Cornell had some folks, I'm calling them street ambassadors, but I know that wasn't the name. You know, just being around, handing out masks, encouraging people to pull up their masks, doing all of that. Are those things still in place? Are you going to continue them? And especially around enforcement, because we know students get back on campus and it's, you know, hey, party time. We're here. So what are you going to be doing?
Let me briefly respond and then turn to Pat and Karen for details. We will continue to be paying strict attention to compliance. There are rigorous and strong repercussions that go all the way up to suspension for failure to comply with the campus code of conduct with COVID-related protocols. So we are, on the one hand, speaking in very strong fashion, but also quite confident based on what we were able to observe how our students took these responsibilities seriously. Yes, there were a few clusters, but we have to remember that when those clusters occurred, the students, and it was the students who self-corrected and enabled us to get through not just one, but two successful semesters from a public health perspective. Pat or Karen, anything else you'd add?
Yeah, they were called the behavioral compact monitors, and they were, and they were actually staff who were then assigned this additional work to do, and they did it well, and it was successful. But I think we have to remember that we weren't vaccinated then. You know, we were completely not vaccinated, and it's a different world now. And I'll be honest, that extra work was really hard on a lot of people. It was a lot of really tough time, late at night, early in the morning. And, you know, the decision was made towards the end of spring that it wasn't fair to these folks to have them do this again, considering how things have changed. Now, of course, the Delta variant is out there. We know that. But again, we're going to be 99% vaccinated among our community. So, and to Joel's point, students do self-correct a lot. And, you know, there's going to be, sure, there's going to be parties. We know that. But I think our students are smart enough and concerned enough and happy enough to be at Cornell that we will have a successful semester.
I appreciate the confidence. And thank you for answering, because these are all questions that are in our community.
Sure.
And, you know, we want to maintain that good relationship with our neighbors who live here permanently. And so they just want to know. I also want to thank you all for coming. Thank you for the messaging, and hope to see more messaging on, you know, billboards and, you know, cabs and sides of buses. Encourage our public to mask up and do all the things. I remember the beautiful messaging about distancing. It was so lovely. Maybe the next set of messaging will be about, you know, masking up and maintaining the other protocols. So thank you. Any last words?
No, just a big thanks again to all of you. And we would be happy to come back anytime. Just reach out to Gary. And we'd be happy to provide additional updates. So thanks for everything you do.
Well, definitely we appreciate your time. Thank you. And Gary, you'll hear from us, because we love having you come, because our community gets to hear at this forum, as many others you do, what's going on campus. And it eases some of the anxiety and nervousness. So thank you again for being here.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Okay, let me get back to the agenda, if I can see what's going on here. Let's go to privilege of the floor for legislators before I go to Frank and COVID update. Any legislators have any stuff you want to share? Henry and then Mike Lane.
Yes, I'd just like to quickly congratulate Kathy Hochul for becoming the 57th governor of the New York State next week, and she'll be the first female in that position. I just wanted to say a quick word. I was going to do a proclamation, but I'll just say a quick word. That's it.
I know, and to think she was going to be our sister friend speaker last year. Anyhow, Mike Lane.
I was waiting for Ann to say it's about time.
Martha was doing it.
And it's about time.
Martha was shimmying the it's about time. Go ahead, Mike.
Thank you. You recall that we had a full count census committee that had basically disbanded. We were not, unfortunately, because our activities were during the shutdown for COVID, we weren't able to do as much as we wanted to, but we had a lot of help from, among other people, Dominic and the Public Information Advisory Board. We're starting to get some of the census information now. If anyone didn't see the article in the Ithaca Voice, please look it up. There is a table there with some general figures for Tompkins County and its municipalities. The population of Tompkins County is up to about 105,000, which is about a 3,000 increase over the past decade. Where we have seen the largest increase is in the city of Ithaca and the town of Ithaca, and quite a jump in the village of Cayuga Heights. The rural towns have seen, many of them have seen reductions. Some have seen increase. I think Lansing went up. Dryden went down. And I don't know what happened to Groton Village, but it seemed to have slipped through the cracks there, Glenn.
Did not
in that table anyway, which I'm sure was just an oversight. It is important that we have grown. Most of the counties around us, we understand, have shrunk in population. New York State increased overall, but even though it increased by 4 or 5%, it did not keep up enough to be able to retain all of our congressional seats, and we are going to lose a seat. And where that will be, we don't know. But since our congressman is not running again, if past history has any gauge of those kinds of things, our district will probably be on the chopping block to be cut up. The redistricting at the county level is moving forward thanks to Amanda Champion's GO committee and the work that she's been chairing there, and we'll be getting our independent redistricting committee to move ahead. I don't want to step on her toes there about her report, but that's important. The state is having hearings. Martha's been working on that through her Tiger committee. For how the state legislature will be redistricted, as well as the congressional seats. And that's pretty important for us. As you know, we currently share, we're split into three Senate districts in Tompkins County, which is problematic. So things are beginning to happen, things that are going to affect us for the next 10 years, whether it's grant programs, whether it's economic development, other places looking at our county as a possible place to grow a business or maybe to retire and live in our beautiful locale. So, stop talking at this point, but I think it's pretty important after all the work that our census committee did that we're beginning to get some results told to us.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for sharing. Martha?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Mike, this article, and I'm looking at the numbers. Deborah, is Kendall in Cayuga Heights?
Yes.
And they expanded in the last 5 or so years, right?
Yes. Considerably.
Do you think they added 385 people? Or
I don't think they added 385 people, no.
Right, but that could have been part of the bump. I wonder how many people from Dryden went to Kendall. I don't know. But. Okay.
At some point, one is just too old for the crown jewel.
So I realize that might have been, you know, a chunk of Cayuga Heights because. That was sort of a surprise. But I thought it was really very gratifying to know that, and maybe we should have said something to the Cornell folks, because they worked really hard to make sure the students were counted, and the students off campus as well as on campus. And the fact that the city shows up with an increase of more than 2,000 residents, almost 7%. That's a big deal. That's a really big deal.
Are some of the new housing at Cornell actually in Cougar Heights? Could that be something that...
But they weren't there in April, or they weren't there in 2020.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else? Anything else to announce? We'll move on. Thank you very much. Continue with our special topics of presentation. COVID updates. We are back to getting our COVID updates. And I'm looking for Frank and Dr. Clayback. And there's Frank and Amy and the EOC as they ramp up. And there's our
Acting County Administrator, Interim County Administrator Lisa Holmes. And go ahead and take it away, Frank, Amy, Lisa.
I'm going to turn it right over to Amy from the EOC perspective.
Hi, everyone. I'm going to start by sharing my slide. Can everyone see it? And is it the right version? All right. I'm seeing a head nod from Lisa, so we'll go ahead. As Leslie mentioned, we're back to our COVID updates, and we'll be walking through these updates again. It was a month ago when we last met, and a lot of things changed, including Frank got some rest. You can notice that he is all recharged and ready to tackle this. He left us this, and so here we go. Some of the things that we saw, our cases have increased. And the other piece to this is Delta is the new normal. So some COVID data, we have seen an increase in total positive cases with 108 active cases as we started today, 14 hospitalized and 32 deaths. So since we last met, unfortunately, we have lost another individual in our community due to COVID, as well as seen an increase in overall cases. We have also seen a slight increase in vaccine doses, so people are still taking the vaccine. You can see over 71,000 people, almost 72,000 have received their first dose, and almost 68,000 have completed their doses. So we are making progress on the vaccine front. Also, since we left last met, the governor has resigned with the lieutenant governor coming on board. This has changed some of our guidance, and we're expecting additional guidance to be coming in the future as the new governor takes action. We did see some guidance come out from the Department of Education. According to them, they're following the CDC guidance, so we're getting that. We've also seen today Department of Health has approved some booster doses for immunocompromised individuals. Frank will be providing more information on that, and I know we will be having a press release soon going out to the community explaining what that means and what that looks like here. We've also seen masks come back since we last were together. We issued an advisory for all of Tompkins County, and then we actually went into a directive for our own businesses, making it so all of our Tompkins County buildings, once again, are masked. We also implemented the county vaccine or testing requirement for our own employees, and we're still working on the logistics for that. That'll begin in October, and in the next 2 weeks or so, we'll continue to update you on how that process is going and what it will look like for our employees. We've also had some more vaccine clinics, and Frank today met with all of the superintendents of the school districts to discuss what fall opening will look like for our K-12 population. We've also continued to meet, as Cornell talked about earlier, with all three higher ed institutions. All of our messages continue to go out, and we are attempting to clarify that all available vaccines are effective in preventing severe disease, hospitalizations, and death. So we'll continue to push out information to everyone. There will soon be a robocall that reminds everyone the importance of masking, as well as how to continue to exist in this environment where COVID is present. Our COVID hours. So the other shift is Frank Frank J. Franklin, Dominic Recchio, and I all resumed our emergency operations center roles starting today, and came back together to talk about how we'll be moving forward. We've been in close communication this entire time, but find it easier when we're all in the same location. So we've started to shift that. And you can also see our COVID-19 hours from others that are putting in time for a while. Dominic and I returned back to our offices, and Jay returned as the assessment director with our focus transitioning a little. And now we're pulling back into more of that COVID world. There's also some leave updates here, and then there's some existing COVID-related expenses, with a major chunk being that CUGA medical testing, as well as some of our contract staffing for nurses. I'm going to turn it over to Frank, who will, on his first day back, be able to walk you through everything that's been happening and what to look forward to.
Thanks, Frank. No pressure.
It's my second day back, Amy. Come on. So first of all, I want to thank Amy, Dominic, Jay, Lisa, Brenda, Harmony back at Public Health and Mental Health, and both staffs for giving me that opportunity to be away. It was very much needed. And as Amy said, I am definitely back and ready to go now, rested and hopefully thinking clearly as we navigate forward. I will point out that I started my vacation on July 23rd, and if you look at this slide, something pretty significant happened very shortly thereafter. So I am continually
blaming. You can never go away again, Frank.
Yeah, so I may never be allowed to have vacation again. But yes, in all seriousness, obviously things have shifted for us. And our case numbers are going up pretty significantly, pretty quickly. We had another big case day today that we'll be reporting in the morning. And I think this really just paints the picture of what's happened over the last 3 or 4 weeks as cases have begun to increase. I think one thing that we want to start talking about, though, is that cases, we knew we were going to see cases in the fall. I think I had been telling you that during previous presentations. We knew there would be another wave that came through. And really what we need to be focusing our attention on is the severity of illness, and what that means for the hospital, what it means for the people that end up in the hospital, and really be focusing our attention there. We will obviously continue to share data on cases, the severity is really where we need to be focused. Next slide, Amy. So what's going on with vaccination clinics? First of all, vaccine is readily available. We checked with all of our local chain pharmacies, and they all have vaccine available. Most of them are doing it on a walk-in basis. One or two, I think, are asking for appointments. But vaccine is readily available in the community through our pharmacies. And many of our local healthcare providers, our primary care providers, also have vaccine available for their patients. So folks should know that they don't have to wait for or look for a county-run clinic to get vaccinated. There is vaccine readily available at their local pharmacy. That being said, we are still doing small clinics throughout the county. We've got them planned for Newfield next week. And then beginning in September, we're helping Tompkins-Cortland Community College do their students that might be returning that are not vaccinated. And then we have a clinic scheduled for Groton. I believe we're also working on a Lansing one as well that should be announced relatively soon. But I do want to point out that the last time we had case numbers this large, the hospital and the mall were operating for vaccines. And so our nurses were able to focus on doing the disease surveillance. It is a challenge for us to do disease numbers this high, as well as operate clinics as well. So we really are going to be asking the public to start taking advantage of those other locations at their pharmacies and with their primary care doctors as the main location to seek vaccination. All that being said, the booster part, sorry, Amy, it might be later. I'll talk about boosters later. We'll come back to that. Go ahead. Go to the next slide. So positive cases, this is a data table that we're now sharing weekly on the website for folks to see. The big question is about, you know, are we seeing breakthrough cases? And the previous 2 weeks, we were showing more than 50% of the positive cases were vaccinated individuals. That has dropped in this the week that we're demonstrating now. We'll see what comes in the coming weeks on how that kind of fluctuates. We do expect, we have a lot of people vaccinated, that we will see breakthrough cases. I saw an example from the CDC where it said if there's 10 people and 9 of them are vaccinated and 2 of them become positive, one was unvaccinated and one was vaccinated, 50% of your cases are in the vaccinated population. But what that doesn't account for is the other 8 vaccinated people that did not become ill. So it just because we're seeing breakthrough cases, particularly because we have a lot higher vaccination rates than many places, we are going to see breakthrough cases. But what we know, what we've seen here locally and what is really occurring across the country is even those vaccinated breakthrough cases, they're not severe cases. In many instances, they're asymptomatic. But beyond that, we're not seeing hospitalizations related to vaccinated individuals. So it's really important to understand that vaccines are still the single best way to protect yourself against severe illness. Also in this chart, sorry, Amy, before you go, one more thing. You'll see the ineligible. We put a notation there because we get a lot of questions about children and how many cases are in that population of 12 and under that are unable to be vaccinated. So in this chart moving forward, you'll always see not eligible for vaccine as a designation in the chart. And those will be the children 12 and under. There may be a rare case where we have somebody that was ineligible for a health condition or some other reason, but those are very, very rare. So most of the ineligible are always going to be children 12 and under. So for folks in the community that are interested in understanding how that's evolving, this is where they can look. And if they look at that not eligible number, it will give them an idea of what we're seeing in the 12 and under population.
Hey, Frank, can you go back to that slide real quickly, if I may interrupt a minute? I'm having a hard time from where I'm sitting differentiating the color of fully vaccinated and not fully vaccinated. So August 1st or August 8th, that first bit there in the darker bit, that's people who were vaccinated?
Correct.
Fully vaccinated?
Yep. And the next color is not fully vaccinated.
Okay.
Next color is not eligible, and the top color is unknown.
Does not fully vaccinated mean somebody got one shot?
Yes.
Okay.
Or they haven't.
Or not vaccinated at all, right?
No. Not fully vaccinated would be one dose. Or they have their second dose, but they have not yet been vaccinated for 2 weeks post the second dose.
Frank, it also includes those who are unvaccinated altogether.
Right.
Who have not received any doses.
Correct.
Okay, so let me just make sure I'm reading this right. So let's go to the August 8th. Mm-hmm. The dark number in the bottom are people who got all their doses of vaccines but tested positive for the virus.
Correct.
Am I reading that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Hospitalizations, as I said earlier, one of the things we need to be, keeping our eye on is what's happening, how severe is the illness in the folks that are testing positive. We've obviously seen an increase in hospitalizations over the last few weeks. We've seen some individuals that have been in ICU and intubated. And the good news is many of them are beginning to recover, and we're starting to see that number fluctuate with folks coming out and new folks, unfortunately going in. But this is what we need to keep our eye on. And we get a lot of questions about what's the hospital capacity. And we talked a lot about this probably this time last year, maybe a little earlier, and what that looks like. And the thing about the hospital is that they can flex. You know, they may have X number of beds, you know, that they identify for ICU beds or for intubations, but they can flex those depending on the needs. And what we're hearing from Dr. Stallone at the hospital is that their business has picked up because they're seeing the delayed medicine that occurred because of COVID over the last year. So the hospital is busier in general as people are beginning to take care of those health needs that might have been delayed because of COVID. And so that coupled with there is a nursing shortage. It's a nationwide nursing shortage, and it is a challenge to find nurses to continue to help support healthcare. So those two things, then you mix in the additional COVID patients, and now the hospital's got this situation where they have to manage what it is they can do based on the staffing and the facility that they have available. So it's really not solely about we have X number of beds, and if we go over that, we have a problem. The hospital will flex, but what it means is that if we have more COVID cases in the hospital, there's other things that potentially could not be accomplished because we have to shift resources. So we're not anywhere close to being out of space for hospital patients for COVID, but we are getting to the point where the hospital has to start managing what they can and can't do with the staffing levels that they have. Next slide. As Amy started the presentation with the Delta variant being the new normal, we can stop asking that question. Our cases are Delta variant. It's in the high 90% the last time that Cornell gave us an update. We are dealing with the Delta variant just as the rest of the country is. And so we just wanted folks to know that. There is there's FAQs on our websites for folks to take a look at. I think one of the things that's important to know is that there is a higher transmission rate with the Delta variant, which is why we're seeing cases go up quicker than we might have seen them in the past. It is still important to know that vaccination is the single best way to protect yourself. There may be breakthrough cases, as we've talked about, but we're still not seeing those folks ending up in the hospital. So even if you were to be in that small group of people that had a breakthrough case, you are more likely to have a mild case of COVID if you are vaccinated. And that's really what we're trying to achieve. We had some questions about a local state of emergency considerations. New York State's expired on June 24th. The county's expired on July 3rd. And the federal declaration is set to expire September 30th. We do expect that will be renewed, but until it is, it is set to expire on the 30th. We're not in a position, at least I don't believe we're in a position where we need to be declaring a local state of emergency. We will be looking at the hospitalization rate, as I've been talking about, the community infection rate, you know, contact tracing capacity, mainly disease severity. That's really going to be an important component of it. And of course, as this evolves, if there are additional variants, we'll be looking at what those mean and meet for us. The emergency powers, the emergency is declared by our county chief executive, which in our instance is our county administrator. It really allows us to do things like emergency orders and mask mandates. There are enforcement concerns with those and how we deal with those. It would allow us to, if we needed to fully reactivate our EOC as well as work on shifting work around for individuals to support the emergency. And it really, the main thing that it does for us, it suspends local policies. It allows us to suspend local policies and procedures in order to more effectively respond if we need them. But we as an EOC team are, you know, at a position where we we feel like we can do it within the existing structures that we have. And if we felt differently, we would certainly consult with Lisa and move forward from there. I think the important thing for the community around the state of emergency is that there's a lot more knowns now than there was the last time we declared one. We didn't know anything about COVID. We were really just flying in the dark, trying to understand what we needed to do. And we needed to make very big, dramatic steps to protect us quickly because there were unknowns. Now we know more. And so we're able to manage it a little bit differently because we do know that. A state of emergency would indicate an emergency level event to residents. And so it sends a message when we declare a state of emergency. And it really, really means we need you to dramatically do things differently and help us, you know, respond to the emergency. At this point, what we need people to do are things that they're aware of, that we've been talking about, that are really part of the community conversation, that a state of emergency isn't really necessary from my perspective at this point to get that messaging out. We're doing it anyway. Moving into more data, this is just kind of updating what we know about the data we've shared in the past. This is the age range data. The only thing that's really shifted is the 0 to 9 and 10 to 19. You know, we've seen it moving up and down a little bit, but generally speaking, things are pretty close to the same that they have been throughout. I don't think there's anything really dramatic in this that that we really need to be concerned about, other than, you know, we are looking at children, particularly with the Delta variant. Race, there really has been minimal movement in our positive cases, and the numbers that we're presenting here are so very small that it's hard to really draw any conclusions from, you know, at this point, other than it's pretty much tracking as it has throughout the pandemic. And the same with ethnicity. Things are staying pretty consistent to what they have been, and our numbers are relatively low still. Vaccination, switching from positives to vaccination demographics, you can see things have not moved very dramatically. We're just not vaccinating huge numbers of people anymore. And so those small numbers, when we're doing 5 or 10 at a time, they're not going to move the needle really on any of these when we've already vaccinated tens of thousands of people.
Frank, can I ask a question about the children? Because we're splitting ages about who's eligible for vaccination there on these demographic charts. Are those mostly children under 12? The 10 to 19 range is kind of capturing two groups, some that are eligible and some that are not.
Yeah, and so I think what you're seeing there is they're 17% of the population, but they're only 8% vaccinated, right? And that's because half of that group isn't, well, not half, but a quarter of that group isn't eligible. So it is a little difficult. I don't think we have the breakdown. I don't think we have the breakdown into those age groups just yet anymore to be able to make any more direct conclusions from it. But yes, what you're seeing there is a reflection of the two age groups together.
Do you think any of the youth vaccination status or youth positive cases are leading you to think that it's important to have clinics before school reopens at schools?
Yeah, we're not yet. We've offered that opportunity. We've been to all of the schools, some of them a couple of times, to offer vaccine opportunities. We are going back out into many of those communities in the next few weeks to offer clinics that obviously parents and students could avail themselves of. Vaccine is readily available, and it's not, we're not in the position anymore where we think we're going to have a huge impact because we do an event. Really, what we're trying to do is get those individuals that haven't yet decided to be vaccinated to choose to be vaccinated and seek it out.
And that's the end of our slides for tonight.
Thank you. Comments, questions, Mike Lane, and Shauna.
Excellent presentation as always. Thank you all. I wondered two things. One, I understand that we're going to be there's going to be third shots for immunocompromised people. Are they on the registry? Do we have a way of getting to them and saying, come get your shot, your third one?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Mike. I never circled back to the boosters. Yeah, so right now it's a very small group of people that are being recommended for that third. And there's a little distinction in the language, right? So for this group of people, they're calling it an additional third vaccine, not necessarily a booster. So I'm just saying that it's semantics. You can call it whatever you want, but you may see in the state language, it talks about an additional vaccine. And then later in the document, it says no boosters are currently being recommended. It's because they're drawing a distinction between the immunocompromised individuals and then just the general booster for anybody that would have gotten vaccinated. So that's just for informational purposes. As far as do we know who these folks are, our recommendation and what we're going to be asking of them is to work with their primary care providers, because who is eligible is a very finite list. There's certain underlying health conditions that are eligible. There's certain medications if you're taking that make you eligible. And there's really no way for us to know at a clinic who meets those criteria. And so really what we're encouraging those individuals to do is work through their primary care provider, or their healthcare provider, to determine if they should be vaccinated. Many of those healthcare providers will have vaccine available and will be able to provide it to them. If they don't, our local pharmacies, where those individuals that are taking those medications or getting them refilled, have access and have availability for the vaccine, so they should be able to get it through those mechanisms. So that's really what we're looking for right now in these early phases. We have heard, and I think it was reported today, that the White House is considering a booster shot for everyone that got vaccinated. And we are working and talking with Cayuga Health Systems about re-implementing the mall site to be able to meet demand related to that. And once it became that broadly available, if it's just anyone and it's after a certain amount of time of your second dose, we would of course take those immunocompromised folks there. It's just very difficult at a small clinic right now that we might be operating to know if an individual meets the criteria. And there's emergency use authorization for that group of people. It's not for anyone that wants it or thinks that they need it. It's really about, do you meet those criteria? And the only ones that are really qualified for making that determination are their healthcare providers that they work with on a regular basis.
Thanks for that. And one other question, if I may, and that is, I've been reading about the Lambda variant out of South America. Have we heard anything on that? Is it here yet?
Yeah, we haven't seen it. I don't believe Cornell has sequenced that anything beyond the Delta variant at this point. So I think to date we have not. As I said, the last time they ran it, it was high 90% Delta, and I think there was one or two cases of the former UK variant that were mixed in with it. So to date, we have not, that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
I know that yesterday Cuomo mandated healthcare workers and people that work in long-term care facilities a mandating of vaccination. Do you foresee this also happening for teachers, those that work in schools and childcare?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even really know the full scope of what that executive order you just referenced covers. We're still waiting for guidance from the Department of Health to expand and add clarity for us on that. You know, there is also, you guys talked about it at the beginning of your meeting with Cornell, there's a changing of the executive leadership, and the person that issued that executive order has already said they're resigning in a week. So really created chaos as far as understanding who is making the decisions and when there's going to be clarity on those types of issues. That being said, you know, as far as mandates, I'm not a fan of them at this point in the pandemic. We are We have given the public the information that we have available to us. Quite frankly, I think we've vaccinated the people that are going to get vaccinated. And mandating things is really going to, in my opinion, is going to entrench those folks that are not vaccinated into not getting vaccinated versus working to try to continue to educate and encourage and offer incentive for people to be to get vaccinated. So, it's hard to know if there will be more beyond the healthcare workforce into schools and such. I believe Onondaga County today said they were going to be mandating it for their schools. There's a lot of consequences that come along with that, that when there's not federal and state support for a mandate that you have to be prepared to address. And I just don't know that we have the resources to be able to address those consequences. So we need to be really mindful about our approach. And we're going to continue making recommendations and educating and communicating about those recommendations. But that's really the path that we're taking at the moment.
And then my other question was in regards to having a mask mandate for the county. What would be the steps that would need to happen?
There's a couple of ways that it can be done. I'll start by saying I don't know that would be my recommendation. So I'll just leave that out there, but you're asking about the steps associated with it. Jonathan would probably have to weigh in to a degree. As the public health director, I do have broad authorities, but it would be hard to point to something that's different in Tompkins County that would warrant using that authority to implement something. Beyond that, declaring an emergency and creating a mandate from there probably is the would be the course of action that would be necessary.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, since the first time we declared a state of emergency, I know that we were the first in the state to do that. And, I was just wondering, since the CDC is urging everyone to do that anyway, I guess what is the breaking point that either you or Lisa would be comfortable announcing that as a necessity in our county?
Yeah, I'll speak for myself and then turn it over to Lisa. We're going to be watching what happens with the disease, as I started with, the severity of what we're seeing. And I don't want to draw a line in the sand because there's so many variables that impact any number that we might look at. It's really going to be a totality of the situation that will drive decision making around what we think we need to do for future steps. But severity of illness in children because they're unable to be vaccinated obviously will be something that we're looking at. Those are kind of the main things that will be triggers for me from a public health perspective. And we'll be continuing to monitor that. I would still say that we've done a really good job in Tompkins County and people are complying with what we're asking them to do. Mandates require enforcement and they also have consequences on the people that you place them that we have to be prepared to address as well without state or federal support. So all of those things have to be weighed into the decision making from my perspective. On when we might move forward making a recommendation like that to Lisa.
Annie, Martha, and then Rich, and then let's wrap it. Pardon?
Frank was going to turn it over to Lisa to answer.
Oh, yes.
State of emergency.
Oh, I would just, I would echo what Frank said. We would be following those key indicators and I think continuing to ask ourselves, what would we be hoping to achieve through issuing a state of emergency that we are unable to achieve, in the current state? So, I think again, just continuing to monitor several key indicators and staying abreast of what's happening locally in terms of needs and capacity.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. Now back to Annie.
Thank you.
Martha, Rich, Henry.
Thank you. So this first question is for Frank. You met with the school superintendents. Are all the schools in the county requiring masks for staff and students?
Yes, I believe they all are planning to follow the New York State Education Department guidance, which does recommend masking. We will be putting out a press release in the coming days about masking as well, reiterating our recommendation that everyone, including vaccinated individuals, when indoors, be wearing a mask, and also saying that we recommend that our local school districts follow the New York State Ed guidance as well as CDC in relation to masking in schools.
Okay, and then will you be announcing locations of positive cases as we did in the spring, such as stores and restaurants, if there are positive cases?
I think what you will see from us is some information about types of locations and scenarios that are creating clusters for us. I don't think you're going to see the announcements. Well, right now we're not planning to make announcements like, well, if you were in Wegmans on this date from this time, you should do something, right? I think at this point, what we're seeing is more prolonged exposures in smaller, tighter areas that are what are creating those location-based cases that we have. And so it's really about the type of location to avoid or be more cautious in than any particular exposure.
Thank you. The last thing is, as far as my math and looking at extrapolating out the positive cases that we have now, it looks to me that if we keep in the current trajectory, in 6 weeks, we're going to be up to 300 active cases, which is, I think we were up to 330 at the height last January 8th, or around there. And so I am concerned, so I'm just wondering what the indicators are that we would, or I guess you talked about some of the indications or some of the things you'd be looking at. I guess I'm wanting more clarity on what we could do if we were going to do something. So, for instance, what a state of emergency, for instance, could give us, whether that was local or at the state. Just thinking about some of the things that could be helpful if we keep going in the direction that we're headed right now. Mask mandates sounds like one of them. And then another one would be closing schools. I'm not advocating for any of these right now. I'm just wondering if I'm missing something, and reduced capacity for certain venues. Are those the top three type things we would do?
Yeah, depending on what we're seeing with the cases, right? It really depends on the scenarios that's driving the case numbers up. And all of those things you mentioned are potential opportunities. The one thing I would share is, we know we're going to see cases. And we may see, case numbers be as high as they've ever been for us, partially because we were extremely fortunate that we did so well in the first year of this. And we need to prepare ourselves for the idea that we will have cases. What we're really concerned about is not overwhelming the healthcare system, reducing the severity of illness amongst the people that are getting sick, and really managing things in a manner that isn't leading towards shutting down like we did in March of 2020, right? I don't think anyone thinks that's a real option in front of us anymore, nor would it really indicate us doing that at this point just because of case numbers. Really what we're looking at is severity of illness. And if we do see that getting to an unmanageable place, or we're seeing folks tragically pass away at numbers that are unacceptable to us, then we'd have to think about what steps we would want to take. But it really would be centered around where we saw the cases coming from and what we felt, what mitigation measures we thought would have the impact that we were looking for.
Thank you. Just the last thing I wanted to mention, we have 14, and that was the number as reported this morning, 14 people in the hospital, and our high that I was 30 last year.
Okay. Martha.
I don't want to prolong this. Frank, has there been any reporting about Delta and surface transmission? I hear everything about throats and nasal passages. Is there any worry about surface contact with objects and et cetera?
Yeah, we want to encourage good hygiene practices, hand washing commonly touched surfaces. But it is not a main area of concern for transmission. It's certainly possible, but the experience has shown us that it's really about the more prolonged close contact with an individual. So, you know, household contacts, being in a confined space for long periods of time, not wearing a mask around folks that are either unvaccinated or potentially or have the disease. So we're not focusing on surfaces other than to continue to encourage basic good hygiene.
Okay. I guess this is a question for Lisa. How is the response from employees to our, vote last week to require vaccination or weekly testing? And I didn't say this at the time, but I'm kind of wondering why we put the start date at October 1st. I would, I wouldn't want people to say, oh, I don't have to do anything till October 1st. I'd like to encourage people to, if they're not vaccinated, to get going earlier.
Sure. So to answer that question, we chose the date of October 1st to allow employees who are currently not vaccinated enough time to get fully vaccinated by that time. So that was the rationale behind that. We've since had an employee town hall where we fielded some questions, really thoughtful questions from employees about the decision. Some were asking about the frequency of testing, how that was going to roll out. Some were asking why are we only choosing to do surveillance testing on unvaccinated people when it's the Delta variant is spreading among those who are both vaccinated and unvaccinated. So there are many people who are fully vaccinated that are asking, can we participate in weekly or biweekly surveillance testing? So those are the kinds of questions that we're getting. And we also have received a number of questions, similar questions about the logistics of the testing from the unions, which we are we're working through and trying to answer for them.
And Lisa,
I was
just going to add in the other piece is logistics of setting up a surveillance testing system. While we'll be working with Kika Health Systems, it's going to take some time to pull that all together and get all of these pieces fully in place.
Okay. And I mean, the goal is not to accommodate surveillance testing, it's to get them vaccinated. So back to Frank, I mean, should we be more proactive? You said we've really vaccinated all the people who are going to get vaccinated. And when I hear Cornell say that 99%, is that what they said of their other staff and faculty or what?
Faculty,
99% of faculty, that's a lot of people that are fully vaccinated. So if that section of our community is fully vaccinated, that means our overall rate or the non-Cornell rate is a lot lower than we're patting ourselves on the back for. So, I sort of feel like, what else can we do? Not just kind of, we're here if you change your mind, but how can we, should we be more proactive? I guess I'm kind of saying I hope we might decide to be more proactive.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Martha, and I do understand it. I think the challenge that we're faced with is that really anything that has talked about mandating has also offered the option of testing as an alternative, right? And so it just becomes a system of are we testing people or are we trying to, you know, continue to educate and make available and encourage people to be vaccinated? I don't know how we would implement a countywide mandate program of any type. I really think what you would find is that would entrench people more against it than we would see if we continue the path of trying to educate and convince people that this is the most appropriate way to move forward. I don't know. I can't really speak to the Cornell environment other than students are required to have any amount number of vaccines to go to school. So it's kind of a common thing for them that they're used to. It's not the same population when you're talking about the general population, their acceptance and or, you know, history with needing to be vaccinated in order to do X, Y, and Z thing beyond, you know, going to school. And these are still all just approved with emergency use authorization, right? They don't have full FDA approval yet. So, you know, that plays a role in the thinking as well.
Yeah, I wasn't meaning institute a mandate any more than we've done with our employees. What I meant was just, you know, be more proactive with, you know, advertising or, you know, just how can we get in people's faces more about doing it. So I just if there's any creativity along those lines, I would appreciate it. So thanks.
Sure.
Thank you, Rich, and then Henry.
Frank, if it's okay, I'll give you a call. So I'll pass.
Thank you. Henry, and then Leslie.
Yeah. Thank you, Brian. I know that I have two quick questions. One is that you keep talking about large indoor gatherings, and I know that, you know, the presentation you had was from Cornell, and there's no limitation on the number of people who can gather now. So they can have a 100-person party. And so I'm wondering, are those large indoor gatherings parties? Are they, I mean, what context do you have for that?
Yeah, we're going to be looking at that over the next few days, Henry, and trying to kind of answer that question for everyone a little bit more clearly about what we're describing when we're talking about the exposure points that we've had. Obviously, we have enough cases now that we need to do that. So I don't have all the information about where all of the gatherings that have occurred that have caused the cases. And there's travel related cases, and there's right. some non-gathering related cases that have just occurred. But to your question about what we should we be doing about events, I think you heard Cornell is, and I think a lot of other places are doing this as well. We've asked people to wear a mask when they're indoors, right? We've asked them to, you know, continue to stay home if they're ill. We have testing available. Both at Cornell and in the community for folks if they feel like they've been exposed or aren't feeling well. So there are those layers of protection that are in place. I don't know that it's very challenging without talking about shutting things down again, right? And that's the challenge. We're trying to balance between continuing to move forward as a community, while at the same time trying to manage the disease. And I just don't think there's enough in Tompkins County at this point, particularly from a severity perspective, to really warrant doing more than what's being recommended by our state and federal partners that are looking at this, you know, across the country and what they're, you know, they're seeing as well. So that's really our thinking. There'll be more information about some of the gatherings coming out. And we can continue this conversation, of course.
The second question is, I voted against the mandate last week for the county employees. And I know that Dr. Capek said that that we talked about surveillance testing. He said Cornell had done these studies, and so their surveillance testing was based on that. I'm wondering what was our surveillance testing based on in terms of once a week for people who are unvaccinated?
Are you asking what established a basis for how often it should happen?
Yes.
Yeah, so we haven't actually established that. I was made aware yesterday that that was now something that was, you know, left to the health department. So I'm working with Dr. Claybeck and others to kind of figure out what makes sense. And then I'll be presenting that to Amy and Lisa as our recommendation. So I don't yet have an answer for that, but we are actively working on it and hope to have it soon.
Thank you.
Great. Last thing? I have you.
Thanks, Greg. Just super quick. It would be great at our October 5th legislature meeting to get an update from you and Lisa about how far we made it with vaccinations for county staff. That would be great to know where we landed on October 1. And is there any movement that you're aware of that we wouldn't be reading about in the paper anyway, as far as the FDA, you know, regulatory change to a regular approval, which we think may gain some more traction for people's interest and, you know, trust, as well as any movement on children's vaccination for emergency approval?
Yeah, you know, you hear rumors of all kinds of things. I don't have an insight or an in anywhere that has some, you know, information that other folks don't have. The last that I heard for both of those was early 2022, is what we were looking at for both the children 12 and under, as well as having full FDA approval on the existing vaccines.
Okay. Anything else for Frank, Lisa, Amy? Thank you all very much. Thanks for the information, for the update. I know we've been going for a little bit, so why don't we take a quick break? And let's be back here to get going at 8 p.m. sharp.
Okay. Welcome back. We'll resume our legislature meeting. Let's go to reports from County Administrator, County Attorney, and Director of Finance, County Administrator Lisa Holmes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep it brief. We were originally scheduled to have an update or a presentation on reimagining public safety tonight, but due to the other presentations on tonight's agenda, we've chosen to defer that. So the legislature will be receiving a more comprehensive update on reimagining public safety and the process on September 7th. And Common Council will be receiving an update on September 1st based on those respective Common Council and Legislature meeting dates. So in the meantime, I'll just mention a couple of brief bullet points on the that topic, as well as a couple of other items to keep everyone aware that that work continues to move forward. The application period for the Community Justice Center positions of Project Director and Data Analyst closed this past Sunday, August 15th. And the redacted applications are under initial review by the respective HR staff from the county as well as the city. The CJC Advisory Board subcommittee has been developed and will include 3 county representatives, 3 city representatives, 2 community representatives, and the designee from the Center for Policing Equity. And email invitations will be sent this week with a goal to begin meeting at the beginning of September. And the respective efforts that the county has committed to around reimagining public safety will be appearing in the 2022 county budget in the form of OTRs. And the City of Ithaca staff and leadership have agreed to share costs on many of those items. So we're working to align all of the respective requests with the city's budget process as well. And that's a segue into my other update, which is that in addition to reimagining public safety and administration's recent renewed activity and presence at the EOC, we're also working on the 2022 budget and plan to present it at the initial presentation at the expanded budget committee meeting on September 14th. And we're also in the process, together with finance, of reviewing the fund balance policy and expect to be sending it out for organizational review and for consideration by the GO committee and the Budget and Capital and Personnel Committee in the full legislature in September. So that's it for my update.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Lisa.
Did we get a fair number of applications for the CJC position?
There are smaller pool than we had originally hoped for. Deanna, do you want to jump in here?
The screening committee will meet on Thursday. We have some folks that are still in the appeal process, so I would hate to give complete numbers because they have 10 days from the time that they appeal to for a response. And so we won't actually know the full totality of the numbers between both positions. But we would say that I would say they're relatively low.
I'm sorry to hear that. Thank you, ladies.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Your microphone.
I said thank you. Thank you both.
Welcome.
County Attorney Jonathan Woods. Anything from you, Jonathan?
No, I do not have a report.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Question?
Jonathan, I can't help but still be wondering about the old library site over there and the lack of activity and whether or not we have any play in that left. And I just, I'm not asking for an answer tonight, but I just might like to be updated on that if there's anything to know about.
Sure, I can tell you what I've heard. I've heard that as a result of COVID, the company doing the project had lost their financing. They had to refinance. They now have financing, as I understand it, but the project builder had already begun another project and is currently finishing up that project. And from what I'm told, they should be done in a couple of weeks. But if, as you know, construction schedules are never certain. And then begin again on that library site. That's what I've heard. I can't swear that is true, but that's my understanding.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Finance Director Rick Schneider. Good to see you, Rick.
Good to see you. Thank you. Welcome to the finance part of the program. I sent an email to each of you that displays the reports I'll be giving tonight. There's three things that we'll be looking at. The first one is the auction. The second one is a casino revenue report. And the third one is our June sales tax figures. In page 6 of your agenda packet begins the discussion on our auction properties that are scheduled for auction on October 25th of this year. This represents 2 years worth of auctions that we're doing this year because we kept bumping the auction back a number of times last year during 2020, and we never had an auction because of COVID. So it really wraps up parcels that are from the 2019 foreclosure and the 2020 foreclosure. There are 9 residential properties and 18 vacant commercial properties, which is a pretty low number when you consider this is for 2 years, for a total of 27 properties. The other documents in your agenda are just spreadsheets and notes from the file, which means the spreadsheets show you which properties are up for auction, and the notes from the file is a little bit about each particular parcel. My comments tonight are just to review what the government operations decided when they met last on August 5th, and that was a result of Darby bringing forth their recommendations on which properties, if any, should be withheld from auction. The result of that GO committee meeting was there will be one parcel withheld from the foreclosure auction. There are protection options ongoing with the Village of Freeville, And this is one property which is a carryover from previous years. There was another decision made not to foreclose due to liability concerns on two stormwater management parcels, and they are in the town of Newfield, and they have been on the foreclosure list since 2019. That also is a carryover from previous years. And there was a decision made to sell one parcel located in the town of Carolyn, subject to deed restrictions, limiting development and buffering environmentally sensitive areas. The notes are included because they have been asked for in the past on what kind of information we have gotten back from the various property owners, whether they're signing their certified mail cards, do we have a proper address, how often do we communicate with the property owners. So we've given you all our notes for each and every parcel in this packet that's in your agenda. Should be noticed that the tax office here in the finance department, we sent the foreclosure proceedings to the legislative office and also to each of the towns and villages. When we do that, we send two copies each, one for the clerk to post and one for the supervisor. And for this last foreclosure, that went out on October 1st, 2020. And the foreclosure notices have also been published in two newspapers, three times each. Last day to pay. This year, the last day for property owners to pay and redeem all parcels for both foreclosures is September 15th, 2021, after which then the county will submit the court order authorizing the transfer of ownership. All property owners in these two foreclosure actions were sent letters with the new pay date by U.S. mail on June 3rd, 2021. So that's a pretty low number when you think we only have five properties that have carried over from last year's auction and 22 in this year's auction for a total of 27. So the packet is yours to use so you can see detail on the properties, and I'll entertain any questions you might have on the auction. Oh, we just found out today and we got word back that we do have a place for the auction that's going to be on October 25th, and it's going to be at the Eagles Club here in Ithaca, 161 Cecil Malone Drive in Ithaca. They just agreed to host us this year for the auction. So I'll take any questions you have on this auction that's scheduled.
Questions?
I probably shouldn't be confused, but I'm a little bit confused. But I thought there was a foreclosure moratorium in place.
We always follow directives that come from the governor's office and the executive orders, and they haven't been updated to my knowledge. Here in New York, I know that there is a foreclosure moratorium that's federally announced. We don't know at this point if that affects tax collection auctions. We know that moratorium is mostly for people that are renters so that they don't get evicted by landlords. We're not sure at this point until we get materials from the state, which we haven't gotten yet, on whether we have to postpone this auction or cancel it due to that moratorium. I'm sure we'll get more information soon.
I mean, is that something we could pass locally, or do we have to wait for state?
Well, we're scheduled. What we do is what we did last year, is we schedule it and we go as if we were on for it, trying to put all the pieces together, and then we just wait for legislative action or executive orders to fall upon us. And I'm part of the treasurer's group, and we all share information back and forth with one another, and we should be consulting with our attorney also. I need to reach out to Jonathan to make sure that, you know, if they get any notice of what we should or can't do this year concerning the moratorium. But I haven't heard anything specific yet that causes us to delay it at this point. Plus, we've pushed it back to a much later date. Instead of June, we've pushed it all the way back to October 25th to give us a little bit of breathing room to discover and find out if indeed we can have the auction this year.
To add, there was a moratorium. The moratorium was actually imposed not by the governor, but by the chief administrator of administrative judge of the state court system. And that has expired. So at least for now, auctions could take place. God knows what will happen in the future.
I guess it would just be like a question maybe for the legislature is, even though we're legally allowed to, should we? And I don't know when we could discuss that.
Well, Mike, we put a lot of work into this so far with a lot of work, getting our auctioneer back online, getting the site made, Darby doing her planning meeting with the GO committee. There's a lot of processing that goes on to putting this on. I mean, there's umpteen hours of staff time that brings us to this point. And as we did last year, obviously we have to cancel when we have to cancel. And we did, you remember last year, we scheduled and rescheduled it 3 times and then gave up. Luckily, most of those properties during the year that ensued, I think we had about 11 that were left over from last year. Most of them came off and paid during that year time lag, till we only had 5 left over from last year. So to the extent that we don't have an auction, and we may not have an auction, I would foresee that a lot of these properties of these 27, a lot of them given more time to pay, especially if they're given a whole nother year to pay, might make good and redeem these properties. But there's no way to tell. This is a very low number for this time of year. When we're coming to you with an auction memo that describes the vacant parcels and the residential parcels, usually the numbers in the 30s, sometimes 40s. But I'll be bringing you more information each week or each month as we find out more information. I wouldn't just want to pull the plug on it at this point, because there's been an awful lot of work that's gone into it with legal staff and with my staff, et cetera.
Dan?
Yes, a couple more things about that. Rick, correct me if I'm wrong, but the residential foreclosures are in place because they stopped paying their taxes 3 years ago, pre-COVID. Is that correct?
Yes. The residential properties have to be 3 years behind, and the other properties, I believe, have to be 2 years behind. So this is, you know, this is just not going after property owners who are delinquent 1 year. You know, these are property owners that have 3 years already to make good and to come forward and pay.
Yes, and I guess that's just, you know, pointing that out, that this is not part of the COVID emergency. This is like a separate issue in my mind.
Right.
Okay. Dan, Martha?
Well, I'm looking at the package, page 14 and 15, and that's vacant and commercial properties. There are 14 of those. So if the purpose is you don't want to foreclose where somebody's living and make somebody homeless, at least those 14, nobody's living in those. And I guess I'm looking through all the other pages. I'm not sure if there's duplication here or whatever, but so at least those 14 could go ahead on an auction, even if we make a decision not to foreclose on where somebody's living. Right?
Well, I don't know if we could legally willy-nilly pick and choose which properties you'd like to foreclose on. But I can tell you the introductory comment in my memo, you know, shows that there are, out of the whole package, there are 9 residential, and some of them are owner occupied and some of those are renters. And there are 18 vacant or commercial properties. So we have twice as many vacant or commercial properties than we have residential properties, only 9 residential.
I guess my, so the question is, can we make a policy choice? I think we've done that before, no? That where we've asked you not to foreclose where somebody was living. Anyway, that would be.
No, that hasn't happened. No.
Okay.
Since I've been here. I don't, legally, you know, we're governed very strictly by, you know, particular state law on how to do this. So we're not giving a lot of leeway on dates. We're not giving a lot of leeway on how we notice, on how we do the auction tour. Everything's fairly specified. So I think we would be very limited, you know, on choosing a particular category or not going forward.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Yeah. On this particular area.
Okay. If we're clear on the auction, and I will bring you up updates on this right up through October if things change. I'd like to share my screen with you and show you what we're doing with the casino revenue. You should be viewing a report right now. It says casino revenue report, second quarter. Do you see that?
Yes.
Thank you. We did real well with casino revenue in the second quarter. I wrote here on this chart, you can see that we made $516,628 for the second quarter. My comments say that we were up exclamation point percent because we had absolutely zero in the second quarter of last year. There's no way to calculate that increase, but we went from zero to 516,000. That means the year-to-date receipts, when you look at both quarters together, were up $515,466 over, or 123.2% up from last year. So we're right on the rebound. Our budget for the year is $675,000. Which was, Jason estimated, very, very low due to the fact that we were in the middle of COVID when we were putting the budget together. But you can see that the two quarters added together here for 2021, we're already up to $934,000. So we exceeded our budget by $250,000 already for 2021. Looks like we're on track, maybe not on being as good as our best year, which was 2019, looks like we're on track to coming in around where we are for 2018. But significant revenues coming in over and above budget, which is good news. I know you like to hear. Any questions on this? Okay. Then I will move to the last item I have. And that is our sales tax. You should be looking at the June sales tax report right now. Do you see that on the screen?
Yeah.
Okay. June, I cautioned that the treasurer's group and a lot of county officials were cautioning that June, which is the end of the second quarter, could not be quite as good as what we saw in April and May because of the changing methodology that the state had employed, and they thought maybe the quarterly adjustment in June might be downward. In actuality, a really great June, and if you move to the center of the spreadsheet here and look at the county's portion, that the you can see that we were up 55.76% just looking at the month of June. And of course that's comparing to a very bad year. So I went back and looked at 2019. If you compare it to 2019, which is a very good year, we're still up 4.2% from the 2019 figures. So if you go over to the year to date section here of our portion, you can see that year-to-date distributions for the county's portion total 19 million $75,672 compared to $15,728,934 last year in 2020. This represents an increase of $3,346,738 year over year, or 21.28%. So that's how much we're up year over year. If we look at how it compares to budget, if you look down here at the bottom of the table, you can see if we're comparing it to gross sales tax revenue, which is all sources of where we have sales tax revenue in the budget, we're at 55.2%, which halfway through the year, anything over 50% is good. If you're looking at just unallocated sales tax revenue, which is unit 9999, which is what county administration usually uses in their budget deliberations, we're at 53.2% of budget. I've let it flow through to the chart, but since I was doing this right before the meeting, I didn't have time to change the chart label over here. So we actually peaked out. This red line here shows the 2021 budget. And I have these 3 years worth 2019, 2020, and 2021 all depicted on this graph. And the green line here in the middle, as I've shown you before, is what our budget is for this year. And the 2019 is the purple, and that's what we're very close to what we were doing in 2019. You can see that the red line, which is this year, 2021, is moving very, very strangely and very, very closely to 2019 numbers. I wonder if that must be something that's how the state must be allocating these taxes. They must be looking at 2019 allocation formulas to do. But the amount of 4.483 million actually pops off the chart here, this red line. And I'll update that next time. But this shows month over month and how well we're doing. And the very last thing I want to share with sales tax is this quarter to date section. And you can see that the county's portion here, if you compare just the second quarter, March, on April, May, June, we're up 54.25% compared to the second quarter for last year. So all in all, a very good sales tax report, and I'll take questions that you might have on this at this time. If not, then I'll stop sharing, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to share this information with you. Thank you.
Question, Rich.
Looking at the graph that you put up, that just seems beyond random, the alignment between 2019 and 2021. Is New York State doing something to influence the amount of sales tax coming to the counties? I mean, I hate to even ask that question, but it just seems incredibly odd.
Well, all we know is that they changed their allocation method. And they did tell us that they do use previous year's data to help allocate and distribute these funds. The formula, I don't know, it's unknown, but they did change it 3 months ago. And ever since then, it's been reflecting very much the same trajectory, not so much of 2020, which is they used to go back and look at the previous year. But now it appears that they're going back 2 years and they're looking at 2019. How that affects or works into their formula, I don't know.
Rick, do you have any opportunity to talk with other finance directors from other counties? I'd be curious if they're seeing the same information.
We're there now.
We ask the same questions month after month, and everybody has the same questions. You know, Dave Lucas is our champion, you know, who comes here from time to time. He also comes to every one of our treasurer groups meeting. He seems to be the sales tax champion or guru that we go to, and he will seek and find answers to our questions through NYSAC the best that he can. But even he has not been able to determine, you know, why and how these allocation methods change like they have changed.
I'm sorry. Are other counties seeing the same alignment between their 2019 numbers and their 2021 numbers?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. Thank you for your time and attention. Appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. So let's move on with the rest of our agenda and try to get through it as quickly as we can. We are, did I skip anybody or anything in the front? I shuffle things around a little bit. No. Are there any resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda? Annie, go ahead.
Yes, it's been a little while. Let me find it. I'd like to withdraw resolution V, as in Victor.
Submitted by a bunch of you all, and I suppose everybody else is in agreement with taking that off. It says submitted by you, Legislator Granison, Schill, Tigler, and Robertson. You're speaking on behalf of everyone. She had not.
Yes.
Thank you. That's what's wrong. Consent agenda. Resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group unless any member of the legislature requested a resolution or appointment be instead included separately. Sorry, Rich.
I'm sorry. In the interest of transparency, one of the resolutions adopts the changes to the Code of Ethics, and we've noticed that there's some formatting errors. We conferred with our legislative clerk, and she indicated they could be treated as manifest corrections.
Okay.
But let me just make a correction there. The resolution on the consent agenda is to set a public hearing for the next legislature meeting on the Code of Ethics.
Ah, okay. Even though we will make those corrections.
Right.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. So, appointments, we have some advisory board appointments. Let me read them all quickly that are on consent agenda. To the Environmental Management Council, Stephanie Redman, Town of Enfield Representative. Pumpkins County Youth Services Board, Randy Smith, Village of Lansing Representative. From the Government Operations Committee, Ernest N. Warren, Supreme Court's Library Board of Trustees, Deborah Dawson, as the county legislator appointed to that. And from the Health and Human Services Committee, Lisa P. Christian, to the Human Rights Commission, and Anjanette Brown, appointed to the Human Rights Commission. Those are all the appointments I have, and I will read the titles of the other resolutions. If you want something pulled off, please indicate, yell it out, because I'm not looking up at you. From Health and Human Services Committee, Resolution A, acceptance of New York State Community Development Grant, CDBG, and Budget Adjustments, Health Department, ID 10310. Resolution B, Budget Adjustments, Tompkins County Office for the Aging, American Rescue Plan 2021 Purchase Authorization, ID 10270. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Resolution C, Budget Adjustments, Establishing Funding Sources for the Recycling and Solid Waste Center, Facility Site Improvements, ID 10251. Government Operations Committee, Resolution D, Adoption of Regular and Supplemental Reports of Footings, Totals, and Assessment Rules, ID 10282. Resolution E, Establishing County Equalization Rates, ID 10281. Resolution F, authorizing a public hearing on proposed local law number blank of 2021, a law amending Chapter
32 of the Tompkins County Code, Code of Ethics, ID 10237, Planning, Energy and Environmental Quality Committee, Resolution G, making a negative declaration of environmental significance in relation to resolution number blank of 2021, authorization to submit application to the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation and Historic Preservation to reestablish two snowmobile trails in Tompkins and Tioga County, ID 10264. Resolution H, authorization to submit application to the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation and Historic Preservation to reestablish two snowmobile trails in Tompkins and Tioga County, ID 10265. From Housing and Economic Development Committee, Resolution I, designation of Tourism Promotion Agency for the State, ID 10222, and Resolution J, authorization to accept a charitable gift from the Park Foundation, the Community Foundation, Lane Family Fund, and the United Way of Tompkins County to support a Summer Youth Employment Program, ID 10277. May I have someone move the consent, please? Moved by Deborah Dawson, seconded by Glenn Morey. All in favor of the consent agenda. And that is everyone. Thank you very much. That passes unanimously. Moving on to the business of our standing committees, reports and resolutions. Starting with Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Leslie. The Public Safety Committee will not be meeting in August, but we'll have its agenda moved to its September meeting. I do have one resolution to put before the legislature. Resolution K, appropriation from contingent fund and extension of position, Assistant Director of Emergency Response, Department of Emergency Response. Can I move it?
Seconded by Glenn Morey. Discussion? Vote?
All in favor? Oh, roll call. Roll call vote, sorry.
Short form.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Anyone want to be recorded as no? Okay, that carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Anything else from you, Rich?
No.
All right. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Yes, we met Monday and had a very full discussion about, we actually received the COVID update today. We wanted to hold off so that we could have a full report on that. We did have a very short report on an update for marijuana legalization. Essentially there is no movement on that. There has been no group that was appointed by the governor. And so it appears that we will not, while marijuana is legal right now, we will not have dispensaries or cultivating until the sounds of it, it sounds like at least 2022. We also talked a little bit about, we had a public comment, an email that was written in by a council member in Enfield, Mr. Lynch, and he was asking if the county might be willing to pay for an individual employee's vaccination, since they would also like to perhaps mandate vaccines.
Yes, testing, I think you mean.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Thank you, Annie. Boy, that would have really created a ruckus. We did have a discussion about that. Amy Hendricks was going to reach out and see if there was any reimbursement from FEMA that might be able to be applied to that. And we are going to continue that conversation in HHS next month. Other than that, we did pass a few resolutions that were on the consent agenda. And we will be meeting the third Monday in September.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions, Annie?
Thanks. I watched that meeting, and I had a question, Shauna, regarding the the topic was brought up regarding marijuana that's legal now, and about would municipalities want to, I don't know how you would codify it, but make certain areas off limits to people smoking it.
Yeah.
I didn't know if you had any more information on that.
Yeah, so I had actually reached out to Jonathan as well as Ted Sheely, and the comment that they had made was that it's actually there are clean air spaces that are noted by New York State. And so while we could go forward with a local law, it appears that New York State actually covers it with the Clean Air Act. And so public or private places would not allow for smoking of marijuana, just like it is tobacco.
So the same places where you can't smoke tobacco.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Martha, Henry, and then Michaeline.
Kit and Sue, Kathy Schlatter gave updates on the ERAP program, and Henry sent around an article today about, like, no money going out virtually, but I don't have the numbers with me. Would you remind us?
Let's see if I wrote the numbers down. I actually don't have the ERAP numbers either. But there is money that has been received by individuals here in the county. I believe there were 84 applications.
I think Kit said there were, like, in the 400s, but there was some duplication. Like, if somebody applied for rental arrears and rental forward and utilities, that could be three applications for one person, right?
Right, that was my understanding as well. But I think that maybe it was in the 80s of people that have received it. I think that was my understanding. Was it around
what HSC said they had fully completed the application?
People are receiving funding though for the ERAP, which is really good because it's been very, very slow to get into people's hands. And there has been a question about applying, and the UMass Services Coalition is helping with that. There's also been issues with landlords needing the funds and not being able to have access to those, too. Thank you.
Henry, and then
Mike Lane. Yeah, I just wanted to say that the state fair is actually allowing weed to be used at the state fair this year.
Awesome.
Just a note.
Oh, boy.
What?
To do what?
You can use weed at the state fair. You can smoke in the smoking areas. You can smoke weed at the state fair this year.
I didn't even know there were smoking areas.
Yeah, I guess the outdoor areas in the state fair can smoke.
They're designated areas. Racist issue.
There was something I was going to say. I was like, no. Mike Lane.
I just wanted to remind us that the Clean Air Act by the state, which prohibits smoking, for example, in bars and things, Tompkins County actually passed a law, which we have on the books, which mimics that. So we have both the state and the Tompkins County law.
Thank you, Mike. Anything else for Shauna? Thank you, Shauna, Health and Human Services Committee.
Thank you.
Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
We haven't met since our last legislature meeting. It seems like it was forever ago. We will meet Thursday at 9 o'clock here in Chambers.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions for Mike? All right. Tompkins Intergovernmental Relations Committee, the Tiger Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslyn. No August meeting, and we've moved the September meeting because of NYSAC 1 week later, so that'll be Tuesday, September 21st at 10 o'clock. Mike said, I did provide testimony at the redistricting public hearing, and I got a message from one of Anna Kellis' staff people that they appreciated the testimony, and Anna would like to come to our next meeting to talk about redistricting. So she's booked in for September 21st. That's what I got.
Thank you, Martha. Questions for Martha?
Just to thank you.
Wonderful. Government Operations
I'm
Committee.
Sure, they're going to listen to me, you know.
Hello.
Stranger things.
Hello. 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 Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion, Chair.
Thank you. We met on August 5th. We had lots and lots of resolutions, many of which you will see here today. Also, speaking of redistricting, we did talk briefly, kind of worked out the timeline for our local redistricting process. As you all know, we will be, this legislature will be appointing a independent redistricting commission, which we need 9 of our community members to join. Dominic, our communications director, has put together some great information. You should have gotten this in email. I think Dom said enough. Please share that with your networks, your neighbors, your residents, your friends. We really hope to get some good applicants. The application period is open from now until September 15th, so people can contact our legislative clerk, fill out an application until September 15th. Through September and October, the Government Operations Committee will be setting up and working on interviews with any applicants. We will discuss and make a decision sometime in November. We hope to have a recommendation for those 9 commissioners by our December 2nd GO meeting. And then we hope that the legislature will pass a resolution to appoint the commissioners on our first meeting in December. So we, several of us talked, December 7th. Several of us talked and we kind of worked backward and tried to make sure there was enough time for all the parts of the process. So that's kind of the rundown. Again, please do share the information. We need 9 people and hope to have lots of good applicants. And other than that, I have, Brittany said I get an award for having the most resolutions.
Before you get to your resolutions, any questions for Amanda? Thank you all for moving along the redistricting committee process there. Thank you. Go ahead.
All right, so the first one is Resolution M, Budget Adjustment and Appropriation of Unspent Funds from 2020 and Prior Years to Various Accounts of the Departments that Report to the Government Operations Committee, ID 10297. And I've moved that.
Seconded by Rich. This is a roll call vote, short roll call vote on it, or any discussion actually on it. Okay, let's take a vote. Short roll call.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Anyone wish to be recorded as no? Okay, that carries.
All right. Resolution N, appropriation from Contingent Fund, Human Resources and Payroll Mitigation Project, Information Technology Services, ID 10295. I would move that.
Seconded by Rich again. Any discussion? Short roll call vote.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Does anyone wish to be recorded as no? Okay, that carries. Let's see how many different voices Henry can have. I mean, different ways to say yes. The next one is not a short vote.
Resolution O, ID.
Hold on.
Oh, sorry.
Leslie, did you have?
Yeah, I'm just wondering about the roll call for GO. I'm on GO, so I just was wondering about the short roll call.
The short roll call is just of the members of the legislature present.
It's the first and last.
Oh, thank you.
Of the list. It rotates every meeting.
So not of the committee.
Yeah.
I think that's what she's trying to get at. So it's not of the committee. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, yes. Yeah. So Resolution O, ID 10294, Resolution authorizing use of American Rescue Plan funds for compliance and reporting requirements.
May I have a second, please? Seconded by Rich Jonigan. Not a short roll call, Henry. I know you were getting ready with the...
This one is a full vote.
Okay. Any discussion? Vote. All in favor? That carries you unanimously.
All right. Resolution P, ID 10293, appropriation from contingent fund, upgrade of internet services, provider bandwidth and technology, information technology services department. We need more bandwidth.
May I have a second, please? Seconded by Rich. Short roll call. Discussion? Short roll call vote.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Come on, Deborah. Leave alone. Anyone wish to be recorded as no? That carries. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Amanda.
All right. Let's see. Resolution Q, ID 10291, suspension of requirements in bylaws relating to open meetings law for advisory boards, committees, and commissions. I would move that.
Second by Rich. Discussion? Yes, Amanda?
I'll just say that this is something that we've discussed for a couple months in GO, and it's basically the easiest way for our advisory boards and committees to adjust their bylaws so they can meet remotely, as many of our boards and committees want to do. This is a way to allow them to do that.
Thank you, Amanda, for the explanation. Henry?
Yeah, do we know how many boards this does not apply to?
There's
Board of Health and...
There's some...
And EMC.
Any that are established by state law or, you know, subject to open meeting. Jonathan can explain better than I can, but...
It does not apply to the Board of Health.
It
applies only to those advisory committees which aren't otherwise required by state law to have open meetings. Many of our advisor committees aren't required by state law to have open meetings. But before Zoom, they always did it anyway, so they have in their bylaws that they will comply with the open meetings law. Then they found that they like Zoom more, that it enables them to have more participation and would probably lose a lot of people if they didn't continue by Zoom. It's not legally required under state law for many advisory committees, but because that's how they'd always been doing it prior to Zoom, that it's in their bylaws. And that's actually true of quite a few of advisory committees. So this would suspend their bylaws to give them an opportunity to change that so they could meet by Zoom. But it would only apply to those advisory committees which aren't required to have open meetings by state law. And the Board of Health is not one of them. They are required to have open meetings by state law.
Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments? Let's take it to a vote. All in favor? That carries unanimously. Thank you. You're a no vote?
No.
Oh, doesn't carry unanimously. So 13 ayes and 1 no. All right, last one. Resolution R, ID 10289, appropriation from contingent fund, increase in 2021 budget assessment department. And I would move that.
Seconded by Rich. This is a short roll call vote. Come on, Henry.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Anyone wish to be recorded as no? Thank you. That carries unanimously.
That's all I got.
Thank you, Amanda. Thank you for humoring me at this time of night. I appreciate it. All right, moving on to planning, energy, and environment. Actually, Amanda, when does GEO meet again?
The first Thursday in September at noon. Sorry, I don't know what day that is.
Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Anne Corman, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We met last on July 26th, and I'll give you a quick overview. From the Department of Planning and Sustainability, they reported their re-advertising for a senior planner position, so unfortunately they had to do that. So that will be done in mid-August with hopes of having somebody on board in late fall. Terry Carroll, our Chief Sustainability Officer, is working on the existing facilities and working on how to get some energy studies done for them, amongst a lot of other things. He's really hit the ground running. He's also asking the PSC, the Public Service Commission, to reconsider the denial of our grant application for $1.5 million for the airport geothermal project. And the Department of Planning and Sustainability also reported that the various departments in the county plan to purchase 11 more electric vehicles this year. And we had a presentation from the Community Food System Plan. Baz Perry presented from the Food Policy Council and provided us with an update. It's a two-year project that is funded by the legislature and the Community Foundation. And this will be an ongoing project, and there is federal grants available for this type of council. So not only are they looking at food access and food affordability, but they're going to be able to implement their own recommendations ongoing. So that's, to me, that's the best of both worlds, figuring out what to do, and then they're going to actually be able to do that. And then Liz Thomas from the Cayuga Lake Watershed Intermunicipal Organization gave us a presentation, and she focused on their new dues structure, and mostly what that is going to be used for is to provide funding for a person, a staff person, to be able to help develop plans for the watershed and look for funding for that. So it's going to be phased in over 3 years, the funding increase. Those are the highlights. The next meeting is August 23rd, Monday at 1:30 next week. And one of the things on the schedule is from Cornell Cooperative Extension. Director Ken Schlather is going to be coming to give us a financial report. And so what we're hoping for is to talk about how our county funds were used last year, and some of the asks that he might be having for this year coming up. So this is going to help us maybe have a deeper dive into this by having it at the committee and possibly less time at the actual extended budget meeting. So I encourage everybody, if you can, to tune into that on Monday to ask your questions you might have of Ken. And we'll also be talking about rescheduling the December committee meeting, because that's very late in the year, just like the last couple of days of the year, so we thought it might be easier to have that a week or two before. And we'll have a resolution abolishing the Homeownership Oversight Committee and the Local Empire Zone Administration Board. Those two programs aren't funded anymore from the state. And if you want more information on that, I can give you more, but that about sums it up.
Thank you, Annie. Questions? Amanda?
I just wanted to, if you don't mind, point out that the watershed IO dues structure that's changing is going to be coming forward to us in the budget process. It's a significant increase for our portion, and it will, I believe, be an OTR through the planning department. So they came to give a presentation, so it's not like brand new news when we get to the budget. It is, but it will be our decision if we want to continue participating in that.
Thank you for bringing that up, Amanda. And also the Food Policy Council will be coming back and asking for some funding also.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you, Annie. Moving on to Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as usual, our sleepy little committee doesn't have much to do. We did, at our last meeting, pass all of these resolutions that just were voted on through GO. And one of the things we discussed was the fact that our September meeting conflicts with NYSAC, and our October meeting would be on a holiday. So we discussed rescheduling those meetings, and Kathy suggested that we didn't necessarily need to have meetings because of all the expanded budget committee meetings. And we thought that was probably a great idea. So, of course, Kathy has informed me already that we need to have a special meeting before our next ledge meeting. And so it goes. Aside from that, I have one resolution.
Hang on, Deborah. Any questions? So, Deborah.
Martha. Yeah, you mean like right before the next ledge meeting?
Yeah.
Okay. So on the 7th, right?
Right. Kathy will get that out to us in her usual prompt fashion. So I would move Resolution S, Budget Adjustment and Appropriation of Unspent Funds from 2020 and prior years to various accounts of the departments that report to the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, ID number 10299.
May I have a second, please? Seconded by Glenn Morey. And these are all the rollover spending, just so people are aware. And this is a short roll call vote.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
May we?
Anyone wish to be recorded as no? They carried unanimously. Thank you. Anything else from you, Deborah?
No, ma'am.
Thank you. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Henry Granison, Chair.
We have not met. We meet in about 8 days.
All right. Thank you. Anything for Henry? Housing and Economic Development Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslyn. We last met on July 22nd, and we had a lot of good reports. Very quickly, Nick Helmholt from Planning said gave us tourism numbers and that the room tax revenue is up. And by June 30th, it was almost back up to all of 2020. 2020 was miserable, but okay, but it's still a little bit below the 2019 rate, but it's definitely popping back, especially B&Bs and the smaller properties, because especially the 5% tax has kicked in. We heard from INHS, Johanna Anderson, the director, gave us a very compelling report about projects that are in the pipeline where they've seen 25 to 40% increases in labor and supply costs and sort of the gaps mostly in projects that are already in the middle of being implemented, a couple of new projects that I think I've mentioned in other places, but a really compelling sort of list of needs for affordable housing. We heard from Workforce Development and met Rosemary Avila, who is the deputy, and she was she mentioned that she's going to be working especially on diversity issues and creating strategies to measure diversity and helping employers to look at their diversity training programs and participation rates. So I'm happy to hear about that. And Jen Gregory from Southern Tier 8 came from Oneonta to visit with us and always has a lot of energy and good reports to share. Those are the main highlights. I will say we are meeting next on August 26th, and I think we may bring back the issue of countywide code enforcement. It's kind of coming up related to this energy stretch code and the state's Climate Act, and we just want to kind of get that back into the conversation. We may also get an update from Scott Doyle about flood maps that are being revised by FEMA. That should be coming out soon. And finally, just want to mention the tour of chain works that's being offered by IAED, site that's 90-some acres up on South Hill. That's set for Monday, August 30th at noon for people to meet up at the gate, and I think we've all gotten that invitation. So hope you'll do that. It's a fascinating site, and I think their plans have changed. If you've seen the site before, you can still enjoy hearing what the new plans are and new proposals that they're working on. And that's just before the county's staff picnic, I just noted, so that you can go to Chainworks and then go to the staff picnic that afternoon, the employee picnic that afternoon. So that's all I've got. Our next meeting is August 26th at 9:30.
Thank you, Martha. Questions for Martha? Annie?
It's not really for Martha, but just thinking about the employee picnic, I just didn't know if we saw anything that they wanted legislators to help out, so I don't know if this is the right time to ask. But I just want to be on the lookout.
Certainly check with HR on that. Heather Buck usually organizes, and we can check with her and share. Okay. Thanks for bringing it up. Thank you, Martha, for mentioning it as well. All right, moving on. Downtown Facilities Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this is a report I've been waiting 2 years to give.
I know, so take your time, man.
Anyway, we met on the 10th of August to the good news that negotiations were successful with the property owners of 300 and 308 Tioga Street. And therefore, we were able to authorize people to go ahead and get this thing done. So tonight we're moving it forward to the legislature for final approval, and I have two resolutions.
Any questions for Dave before he jumps into his resolutions? Let him say for the moment. Go ahead, Annie.
Something I was supposed to say earlier about something else. It's about time.
Glad you got that in there.
All right.
Okay, resolution L. Making a negative declaration of environmental significance in relation to resolution number blank of 2021, authorizing acquisition of property for a new downtown county governmental office building ID 10302. And I so move.
Seconded by Deb Dawson. Discussion. All right, let's take it to a vote. All in favor? That carries unanimously.
No.
Who did not vote? Amanda was a no vote. Thank you. 13-1.
Resolution U, authorizing acquisition of property for new downtown county government office building ID 10301. And I would move that.
Seconded by Martha Robertson. Discussion, Dan Klein.
Thank you. This topic has captured public attention. I don't know how many of you have spoken with residents about it, but I certainly got asked about it a couple of times. And it's pretty interesting what people are hearing and thinking. And just tonight, in privilege of the floor for the public, a person spoke and talked about Building C, where the Board of Elections is, and said that that building was slated for demolition. Well, that is a possible outcome, but it's certainly not been decided by anybody that that is a plan. My point in bringing that up is I do support this resolution. However, it's very important to me that the message we're sending out is that we have not made any plan at all, zero. We have not decided anything about what might be built, what will be built, what won't be built, where it will be built. And so with that in mind, I have an amendment that I would like to move. My amendment would be to, first of all, eliminate the eighth whereas that says, whereas county administration and county staff have determined the sites at 300 North Tioga Street and 308 North Tioga Street are more desirable than other available sites. And then also, I would like to make a few word changes in the first resolved. These are on lines 41 and 42. So maybe the best way for me is to read it as I would like to propose it, and then I can highlight what it is I'm actually eliminating. So the way I would like to see it worded, resolved on recommendation of the Downtown Facilities Committee that the county legislature determines that the sites at 300 North Tioga Street, currently owned by KeyBank National Association, P.O. Box 428, Buffalo, New York, and 308 North Tioga Street, currently owned by Ithaca Professional Building Incorporated, are options for a new office building site where multiple offices might be consolidated at a single location. So to put it the other way, I'm proposing we eliminate the words the best, now available, and change could to might. That's my proposed amendment.
So I'm going to look at the mover and seconder. Wait a minute, I can't remember what our new rules say about friendly stuff.
Mover, second. Whatever.
Is it accepted as friendly by the mover and seconder?
Yes, friendly.
I would like to leave in that eighth whereas, but I'm okay with the part in the resolve.
Okay, then we'll take it to a vote. So let's start with the removal, the elimination of the eighth whereas. I need a second. Dan, you're moving that as an amendment. Seconded by Mike Sigler? Okay. Seconded by Mike Sigler. Discussion? Martha, then Deborah?
Yeah, I think to answer the public's question, which is, why are we doing this when we just bought other land, which is what I assume is what some people are hearing. This answers that, is that this site is more desirable. I think that is a true statement. I think it's not just true in my mind, but or in many people's mind, but county administration and county staff have advised us that that's a strategic corner. In fact, a little bit, Dave. I've been waiting 20 years to vote. 20 years to vote for this, not just two, because that was one of, as I said at the committee meeting, one of the first things a staff person told me 20 years ago when I was first elected. That we think we might have a chance to buy that bank building, and we think that'd be a great site. Like, whether it was for whatever it was, but the county should, it's a strategic parcel and the county should have it. So I think in the interest of communicating to the public that our staff has advised us this is a desirable site and it's worth basically buying this, even though we have farther down the block on Tioga Street purchased property, I would like to leave that in there.
Thank you. Deborah.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. I guess, as I understand your concerns, Dan, you want to reassure the public that the legislature has not made any decisions about how it wants to proceed. And so while I support your changes to that first resolve, I think that removing the eighth whereas kind of, I mean, I don't know that that's our place, because county administration and county staff have made a determination that this is a desirable site. And it's more desirable than the other available ones. So I guess I would split the baby, you know, and go along with the changes in the resolve clause, but I don't know that it's our place necessarily to remove any reference to a decision or a determination that county admin and staff have made.
Thank you all. Now, we don't need to belabor this all night. And, you know, if somebody has something really profound they have to say about it, otherwise I'd like to vote on the elimination of that whereas. Does anybody have something really, really, they really want to say about eliminating it? No? All right. So let's vote on the amendment that's on the floor. So eliminate the eighth whereas. Whereas county administration and county staff have determined the sites of 300 North Tiger Street and 308 North Tiger Street are more desirable than other available sites.
I have clarification. So a yes vote eliminates the whereas.
A yes vote eliminates it.
Thank
and
you.
No vote keeps it as is in there at this point. So all in favor of eliminating that eighth whereas, please indicate by raising your hands. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 votes to take it out. All those who are opposed to taking it out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That carries. So that eighth whereas is now eliminated. Now let's go to the resolve. You want to move your amendments on that one, Dan?
I believe that one was accepted as friendly, right?
Yeah.
That one's accepted as friendly?
Yes.
To the mover and seconder?
Yes.
Okay. All right, then we don't have to do anything with it. So now we have...
Well, just a clarification with the friendly thing. If anybody else objects to that being friendly, we can move it to a vote.
Right. Right. So let's move to a vote on the amended resolution that's on the table now. So the new resolution. So all in favor. Oh, wait a minute, is there discussion? Go ahead, Bert.
Just to clarify my vote on the amendment, I was in the odd position of really not liking the amendment very much, but I very clearly wanted Dan to vote in favor of this resolution. And so I voted for his amendment to soften the language. But I'm excited about this. I think this is a really positive move for us as a legislature and for the county. I think they're, having looked at this issue for a very long time, this is really a positive option. And I think I just wanted to make that clear on the record. Thanks.
Thank you, Rich. Often I sit here as chair often. I feel like, you know, everybody else should speak and not me. but I do have to say this has been a difficult one for me. There's no secret that I have been opposed to us buying property when we had property and got rid of it. And continue to say we didn't need the property for us. And, you know, some of us warned against that. You know, the old library property that we were talking about tonight. And not, you know, a few years later, here we are. So this has been a really tough one for me to support, and I don't know that I will, I'll probably go down opposing it. Although it's exciting, I probably will go down opposing it for the very reasons that I just mentioned. Martha.
Just quickly, Sue Compton, who spoke before, is one of the co-owners of the Boardman House. And several years ago, when we were first talking about all of this, she invited me to go and visit and look and actually go up to the cupola at the top of the Boardman House, which is so fun. And she was very concerned about what the county might do if we purchased the property. So I think it's a big step that she came tonight and that she's in support of what we might do and, you know, has some interest, and Lisa called her a couple weeks ago, which I think was a really big plus. So it's to have the neighbors say that this is she's looking forward to it, I think is a very positive thing.
All right, let's take this to a vote. Yep, sorry, Leslie.
Just one last thing. As a representative of one of our city districts, I just want to say that this will be really important, I think, for downtown and for downtown communities. It's just outside of my district, but I think that communities appreciate when investment from both their government and, of course, private businesses comes into their downtown area and into their community. And it's right at the edge of where residential meets our commercial district, right, our downtown district. It can really be a lively place. We've seen some of these areas have, you know, some amount of activity, but to think of a place where it's for the public, it's serving the public, it's easy to get to, it's pretty exciting, actually. And so there's a lot of potential here. I know there are a lot of concerns. I recognize those. I appreciate those. I assume that the next legislature will do due diligence and do a really good job thinking about this.
Thank you for your comments. Let's take it to a vote. All in favor of the amended resolution, which, let me just repeat this. What am I doing?
Why is this not a roll call? We're spending $3 million.
If you would like for it to be a roll call vote, you can ask for it to be a roll call vote.
I'm just curious. I guess I have some fundamental misunderstanding.
It's not a bond resolution.
Right.
Oh, okay.
But you can also request for it to be a roll call vote.
No, I don't want to put anybody on the spot.
I just want to repeat very quickly. It is authorizing acquisition of property for a new downtown county government office building. And thank you, Dave, for heading up this committee. All in favor? And please keep your hands up so that our clerks can record who all is voting. 13 ayes. No, 12 ayes. And those opposed? 2 nays. Thank you very much. Like Britt said, it's I will come back and visit you all in the new facility. Hopefully you'll have a chair for me.
One more thing, Leslin.
Go ahead.
Do you want to have a discussion at the next meeting of this committee as to what we're going to do next, or do you want to do it previous?
Why don't you and I talk about it, and we'll and Shauna, and we'll figure out what we do next with the Downtown Facilities Committee.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Leslin.
I was suggesting to Dave that him, Shauna, and I can talk about what we do next with Downtown Facilities Committee if it continues. I don't think your work is done yet. Don't even try it. You know, we'll make work for you, man.
Not a problem. I just like knowing where I'm going.
Well, let's talk about it. All right. Thank you. If there is no other business from Downtown Facility, let's move on to the minutes of the previous meeting. Moved by Shauna Black. May I have a second on the minutes, please? Seconded by Amanda Champion. Any major corrections to the minutes? No. Let's vote on the minutes. All in favor of the minutes as presented to us. That carries unanimously. Thank you very much. There's no unfinished business except that I need a motion to go into executive session for the purposes of discussing personal matter related to a particular person and position. Moved by Henry Granison, seconded by Leslie Schell. I don't know if we're going to take action in executive session. I don't think we will. I think we will come out of exec session just to adjourn. Jonathan, I'm sorry.
I was going to ask an additional real question. I'm going to say if you don't need
me for this executive session. Is that correct?
No, sir.
Okay.
Or me?
And Rick, and no, Rick. Thank you.
I was hoping for some overtime.
Lisa, hang out. We might need you. I'm not sure. Ruby.
Night.
Yes, we'll need you. We might need you, Ruby.
Okay.
Kathy, can I stop the recording? Okay.
So.
Recording stopped.
We'll stop recording. We'll shut down streaming. And we'll resume. Hopefully, it's not going to take us a very long time.